show. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. I don't know how it is for you, but this is not a good Friday. Yeah, this is kind of a crummy Friday, really. I mean, it's not even like our local Chinese restaurant. It's just okay. It's not good. It's not great. It's okay. It's gray and leaden outside. And temps in the 40s and the wind's howling. But then again, the President of the United States today wished everybody a happy Good Friday. So, well, yeah, whatever. Yeah, hi, I'm Bob. This is The Horn. HeadOn.live is where you'll find us on the interweb tubes. If you'd like to be part of the merry, wacky, zany, real-time multimedia extravaganza that is The Horn chat room, well, jump on over, click on chat room, pick out a screen name and a password if you never have before, and you will be immediately greeted by the likes of Anatole and House of Roberts and Otto and Squeaky. With more wandering by because we don't have a tardy bell.
Right.
And capably moderated by longtime inveterate, indefatigable veteran chat room moderator, Sparky, who, because it is a sunny and beautiful day where he is, has folded the space, being a third stage guild navigator, to become Man Cave. Yes. Well, I can't figure out the math, but anyway, it's a religious holiday. And every program here at The Horn begins with gratitude. This one is no different. Thanks to our 10th day of the month subscribers, we're moving into the lean period of the subscriptions as we move into the second and third weeks of the month. But thank you very kindly to Daniel and Don and Judy. Thank you very kindly for being partial sponsors of the program. It is, it's never been more important to help keep all of this going because, you know, remember, no ads about picking up bowling balls with vacuum cleaners and dropping them on Swedish mattresses and all of that business. No buy gold now. And, you know, I'm really, really, really behind the game on the colloidal silver fad. The Food and Drug Administration just sent out a rather detailed warning to Alex Jones over his hustling of, let's see here, super blue silver immune gargle, super silver whitening toothpaste, super silver wound dressing gel, and super blue fluoride-free toothpaste, all of which he was hustling as, sure enough, no kidding, cures for the coronavirus. Mm-hmm. At one point he said, in regard to his bullshit products, "I'm not going to belabor this. I'm just going to tell you that for just your daily life and your gums and your teeth and for regular viruses and bacteria, the patented nanosilver we have, the Pentagon has come out and documented, and Homeland Security have said this stuff kills the whole SARS corona family at point-blank range." Well, of course it does. It kills every virus, but they found that this is 13 years ago, and the Pentagon uses the product we have. And every day, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff drinks a great big old heaping glass of paleo chocolate chicken bone beverage. I added the last part about the chocolate chicken bone, because anytime you talk about Alex Jones, you got to get into the chocolate chicken bone stuff. Yeah. Well, the FDA told him to take immediate action and cease the sale of those products. The FDA adding, currently there are no FDA-approved drugs specifically for the treatment of COVID-19. I don't know. Maybe Horn Nutraceuticals needs to fire back up and get in on the colloidal silver gig. I mean, look what we did for sex clams there at Horn Nutraceuticals. Yeah. All kidding aside, the fundraising goal is somewhere north of $500, and the anonymous. When Donnie chooses, you loses challenge is on the table, and something else for a little bit later as well. There's $180 left in that challenge, and Ralphs wants to get that started, saying that the first $10 that come in toward that challenge, she will match. Thank you, Ralphs. And so hopefully we'll knock it all down and won't be too beat up at the end of the week. Yeah, I know. Flavio says, I keep telling you, Horn Nutraceuticals needs to get in on the grift. But, you know, I think it's just that we're so late to the game, and we're a small operation, so by the time we catch on to the fads of, you know, super beets and colloidal silver and Sea of Galilee mud mask, and, well, the market's already been cornered and saturated, and doggone it. Yeah, right. So, by the way, this is Friday on the Front Porch, and here in about an hour or so, we will get everything fired up. If you'd like to participate, well, there's a big banner at headon.live right there at the top of the page, and if you click that, it'll carry you over the river and through the trees and into the old holler tree that we sublet from the Keebler Elves, wherein Sparky wields the lightsaber and moderates the Friday on the Front Porch conversation group. Okay, so if you'd like to be part of it, click now, and we'll get going here in about 50 minutes or so. And thank you very kindly, Lady B, jumped right in and met Ralph's challenge. So. Yeah, that means there's $160 to go on the When Donnie Chooses, You Loses challenge. Yeah, what's that? Steve in New York says, okay. That, a new Horn Nutraceuticals product. You've heard of colloidal silver. Here at Horn Nutraceuticals, we're offering coital silver. Yes, yes. You thought that the jade vagina egg was a thing? Coital silver may be just what you need. Contains no silver whatsoever. Right. But I wanted to get the conversation started this evening with a couple of things. One, and this will just take a second, I have to observe an ancient ritual because this is a special weekend. Long ago, I was told by an Italian friend of mine that this was the last great Italian joke. There's nothing nasty about it or mean or rude. It's culturally, it wouldn't work as anybody else. And it has to do with this time of the year. And it has to do with an old, old retired priest who, back around the turn of the 19th into the 20th century, had immigrated from Italy to the United States, going through Ellis Island and all of that. And well, even though he was a retired priest, he still wanted to be something to his community, and so he spoke English as well as Italian. And there in the immigrant community, there was desperate need for the teaching of English. And so what he did is he decided that he would teach English to the new Italian immigrants. And the old priest set up classes, and people came along, And he'd worked with them, and they'd worked on their English. There'll be an accent involved with this. Don't anybody get offended. And so there they were this time of year, and he looks at his class, and he says, "It's the Easter coming. Who here, using your English, Can you tell me what Easter means? An eager young Mario sticks up his hand and he says, Mario, what does the Easter mean? And Mario says, Easter. That's at that time of the year when it's so cold in the winter time, and the fat, jolly man with the red suit coming down the chimney and leave a present for all the good little boys and girls. And he says, it's very good, Mario, but that's Christmas when we celebrate the birth of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Mario says, oh, who else wants to try Easter? And Luigi sticks up his hand. He says, Luigi, you try. And Luigi, he says, Easter, that's at the time of the year when it's so hot at the end of the summer, and a brass band march up and down the street, and they play the patriotic music, and the fireworks go off at night. And the old priest says, no, Luigi, nice try, but that's Independence Day. That's when we celebrate the birth of our new country here. Luigi says, oh. And finally, and he seldom says anything, but old Nunzio, older even than the priest himself, raises his shaking hand, and the priest says, Nunzio, you tell us what Easter is. And old Nunzio stands up and draws himself up to his full height. And he says, many, many years ago, the Romans, our people, they nail up a Jesus Christ on the cross. And the old priest is beginning to beam, and he says, and they let him hang there till he die. Our Lord and Savior, they kill him dead on the cross. And old Nunzio's getting into it, and the priest is just beaming. He says, yes, Nunzio, go on, finish the story. And old Nunzio says, 3 days later, they roll the rock away from where they bury him. And Jesus Christ, he come a-walking out. He's as alive as you and me. And the priest is going wild. And he says, yes, Nunzio, yes. What else? And old Nunzio says, Jesus Christ, he look a-left, he look a-right, he look a-down on the ground, he see a shadow, run back in, don't come out. 6 more weeks. And that is our Easter tradition here. The greatest Easter joke ever told. Yes. God, I'm trying to think how long I've been telling that joke. It goes back to at least like 1987 or so. But that's it. That's the last great Easter joke. No laugh tracks here at the Horn. I had to get that out of the way because, you know, Happy Good Friday and all of that, like Corona Caligula says. But I planned something a little special for this afternoon. You've heard me mention, and you've heard, depending on how long you've been a member of this community, you've heard me talk about, and sometimes talk to, our dear friend Dr. John. Dr. John is a trained and brilliant archaeologist as well as a fantastic writer and journalist. And I wanted to get him on the line to talk a little bit about the sort of broader scope of human culture, especially as it relates to great cultural upheavals. And Dr. John kindly agreed. So welcome, one and all, our dear friend Dr. John to the conversation. Hey, Dr. John, how are you?
Hey there, Bob. Doing great. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you sound wonderful.
All terrific. Well, listen, you laid me low there. First we had coital silver, and then a terrific joke about my people. So I appreciate that.
it's just such a lovely story. I love old Nunzio so much.
I think I'll probably get some Nunzios kicking around in my family if I look hard enough, bro.
let me just check in. What's the most important thing?
How are you and your lovely wife and your youngins doing through all of this madness?
We're doing as well as can be. We're out here in sort of the hinterlands in New Mexico, and pretty isolated. Our sort of resting state is isolation, so it's not all
like
that different.
A lot like West Virginia in many ways.
Yeah, the parallels are interesting, although I think we're doing a better job of handling the crisis than you folks are.
I think you probably are.
Yeah, we've got a pretty proactive governor. The only thing is, of course, my wife and I work remote, but now we've got that plus teaching kids, which I'm sure a lot of folks in the family are in the same situation. And I decided we've all just got to be a lot more comfortable with mediocrity than we have been.
Comfortable with mediocrity. That could be a bumper sticker, you know.
Yeah, that's kind of my base state. But no, we're well, thank you. I've got some family that got some folks that have been laid off because of all this stuff. But New Mexico again is doing a pretty good job of taking care of people, and I hope similar stories are true for you and other folks in the family here.
Out in your neck of the woods, the one story that I've been most concerned about. Okay, I got two stories out in New Mexico way that concern me. One is the fact that I have a daughter who is pregnant in the middle of all of this, so that's a source of constant concern. But the other is the impact this is having on the indigenous culture out there.
Yeah, they're starting to be reporting out of that, and it's a little different because a lot of the health on the, especially the Pueblo reservations, are done by the feds. But there's starting to be new numbers coming out that are pretty chilling. On a couple of them, the infection rates are higher than in New York City, and of course we're dealing with smaller pops. But we're talking about a radically different way of life, which is, I think, kind of some of the stuff we want to get into today. But you've got people who live more communally, who work together to plant. It's that time of year. Maybe you've got a well that you have to draw with other families, and it's impossible to isolate in those conditions.
And it there's all too much of an echo. And I guess we will start working toward our topic now. When I began reading the stories about what your governor was describing as you know, the crisis in the indigenous community in New Mexico and Arizona, one of the first things that came to mind was, well, it's 500 years ago all over again.
Yeah, right on. This is interesting in many ways. For one thing, these sort of airborne viral pathogen things are fairly new, or at least we don't necessarily know how well things like this have swept across people before, you know, in prehistory. I mean, so yeah, the contact period in the Americas is a great example, but what was happening there were things like, you know, measles and other diseases like that. Syphilis, interestingly, seems to have kind of gone backwards.
But, yeah, that was their gift. That was their gift to us, and we kind of earned it, really.
It seems that way. But you know, when we talk about what's the deep past of this kind of condition, we don't have a great idea. In terms of archaeology, we really need a disease to have an impact on the skeleton to really know what happened. And this kind of stuff, something that kills you quickly, doesn't do that. And I hate to be, you know, kind of crass about it, but that's the truth. So, you know, that we know about tuberculosis, for instance, but that's a disease of crowding. There's been some cool genetic work on HPV. So we can actually sort of go back in time and reconstruct what the gene sequences looked like in that disease. And we know that, hey, when humans started to become, you know, more modern, maybe 30,000 years ago, all of a sudden HPV starts to mutate like crazy. So that means that it was getting spread around, these little populations that were bumping up against each other. But stuff like this, you know, flu is new, relatively. I mean, it probably swept through Rome a couple of times, but we haven't really understood the connection and the fact that it comes from birds and stuff, you know, really since the Spanish flu epidemic, early 20th century. So this stuff is in the long scheme of humans dealing with pathogens. This is really all pretty novel.
But, and there are a lot of, I think, I think what I was thinking about when we started discussing this conversation was the ability of something like this to, you know, we think of the, I mean, that Trump has described this as, it's a scourge. Yeah, could someone please tell him how to pronounce fucking scourge? I mean, it's Easter. Jesus was scourged. But I'm sorry. I mean, try not to throw too many of the F-bombs around. I don't know if the youngins are about. But the thing is, these are the kinds of upheavals that as much define us as human beings as lay us low, are they not? I mean, you can find references to plague and disease in, I think, the Epic of Gilgamesh, and certainly in the Old Testament, and most likely the Egyptian Book of the Dead, the Popol Vuh, the Bhagavad Gita. It's one of the first things, and I'm trying to take a view of it, Dr. John, as a means of not simply seeing it in the present, but as part of the human experience, because the human experience isn't always lovely and wonderful.
Yeah, it's a great point. So you think there's always this tension between you imagine that culture, you know, writ large. Don't worry about defining it right now, but we've all got it. It's what makes us people. So you imagine culture is this big system with all these inputs and outputs, and you can think about it as this system that's in equilibrium, right? So stuff comes from the outside that wants to make changes, but culture has these mechanisms that keep them in place. So, you know, disease is a huge external, effect. And we've constantly dealt with it, but it's kind of hard to think of really good examples where a lot of change has happened just because of that, because culture tends to be so stable. So, you know, the contact period in the Americas, you think about, well, what changed there? Well, everything. I mean, that was a huge watershed event, and the impact was so huge and so strong, and the ripple effects are being felt today, right? The Black Death sweeping through Europe, right? The entire world, but, you know, we think about Europe, right? So, you know, you lose maybe a third of the population, but you lose maybe half of the clergy, okay? So what does that mean? Well, these are the people who, the only educated, quote-unquote, people at the time were the village priests. They could probably read Latin. They could at least say enough to do the mass, right? So, you know, maybe half of the clergy or more died. Okay, so what happens then? Well, you get this next generation of people who had been farming the day before. You know, well, all of a sudden, hey, you're the village priest now because we got to have a priest. We got to marry people and bury people. Okay, so the new priest can't read Latin, can't do any teaching, can't do any tutoring, don't have this education, and didn't read the old fathers. You know, and so you have this growing sort of corruption and inability to serve the people, and you get the Reformation. So I guess the point is, when we deal with disease, especially, or any sort of external cultural output, you know, it's not that churches went away. It's not that everybody went back to being pagans again. It's that something happened and it rippled and it bounced around in this huge system that is, you know, human culture. And then something gets out of whack, and then something else has to come from the outside to fix it, to bring it back into equilibrium, right? So, I, you know, it's a long way of saying that your point is exactly right, that we grapple with this stuff, and we do it as people, and we always have. But when you try to say, well, then this outcome is going to happen, you almost can't do that, because, you know, there's so much there that keeps the lid on radical change. So, yeah, this is upheaval, but, you know, is it going to change the way we are? Not without a lot of will.
Right, and not without other externalities coming into play. I mean, you use the Black Plague as an example. Mm-hmm. Well, the fact that, you know, we often point to the Renaissance as being sort of midwifed by the Black Plague, because it created, it actually put power into the hands of peasants who decided maybe they didn't want to be peasants anymore, who didn't want to be villeins or serfs or whatever we were calling them, and gave rise to the merchant class that then gives rise to the Renaissance. But outside of the disease process, at the same time, you also have the cultural infusion that comes from the collapse of the Byzantine Constantinople in later on in 1453, because it is less than 100 years between the arrival of the Black Plague and the arrival of previously lost learning back into the West from which it originated.
Right, to quote-unquote save it from the infidels who, by the way, had been doing science for 800 years,
right.
Of course. You know, but also we rescue these Greek texts, and people, you know, refugees from the Byzantines could read them, and they go into the West, and they start to spread it around. And so we get this rebirth of these ancient philosophical ideas. Absolutely. That's it. You know, we delude ourselves into thinking that change is progress is good, right? There's this progression. The new thing is better, right? But you know, if you look at the scope of history, over and over again, we see that's not the case. So the Renaissance itself is founded on these ancient ideas that had been considered pre-Christian, not good enough, right? But then they come back and they're reinterpreted. An example probably some folks know about there's a terrific little book called Giving Up the Gun. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
No.
So the whole story is this is sort of like feudal Tokugawa, whatever, Japan. The British make contact with Japan, the country opens up, import-export happens, firearms get introduced to this previous, feudal samurai culture, and all of a sudden, everybody's got a gun, peasants can kill nobles from a distance, you don't have to be trained to use a sword, and what happens is this really interesting sort of cultural lid gets clamped down where the samurai and the nobles say, oh, wait, we can't do this. This is upsetting our whole society. So Japan as a society moves away from this progressive technology of firearms and goes back to and then elevates this concept of the warrior sword nobility samurai. So, you know, guns go away because of a cultural decision that was made by people in power, you know, unlike, you know, the fallout from the Black Death, where, you know, the peasants actually got power, you know, it was taken away in this other case.
Well, the peasants who did get power in Europe, though, paid a horrible price. If you become familiar with the uprisings of the Jacquerie in France, you'll find that the minute they got uppity, they got slaughtered. And that happened on a number of occasions. It's interesting you bring up that aspect out of feudal Japan, because another good example that I was thinking about the other day, and I know you're well aware of them, are the treasure fleets of China. These were mass, and some people still argue that the treasure fleets may have reached the west coast of the Americas. There's certainly nothing in the archaeological record, but there are a couple of tantalizing little spots here and there. And we know they got to the west. We know they made it, I think, to both sides of the African continent. But these were massive, massive trade undertakings, and they were a show of force by the dynasty in power in China at the time. And it was projected out into the whole wide world. I mean, if just to read up on them is amazing, because this was shipbuilding and seafaring technology the likes of which the world had never seen. Vast cargo ships, huge trade networks, and while the treasure fleet was at sea, there was a change in the dynasty. There was an overthrow, and they get back. And they are immediately suppressed, and China, where it had before been expanding into the world, suddenly contracts in upon itself. because they did not, because whatever was coming in was deemed to be, well, the treasure fleet itself was from the previous dynasty, and there was just too much of the outside world coming into China, and there was a clamp down there. And so as and so as a consequence, the next thing that happens is after the after the Spanish got to the New World, they got to the other side of Mexico and kept going. And of course, we know about Magellan and Balboa, and they reached the Philippines, and then they make the leap from the Philippines to China, and there's a reopening. But all of this comes as a deliberate response to external stimuli. And external stimuli can be a disease, like we're talking about. It can be a change in technology. And it can be something as simple as a change in regime. You know,
yeah.
We being the warlike folk that we are, I've also been thinking about the plagues that that struck Athens. And ended up killing Pericles himself and wiped out the Athenian democracy.
Right. And so, you know, at maybe even more fundamental than that, I guess, you know, the Neolithic revolution, right? So what comes about when we decide to settle down and start planting stuff and seeing what grows, you know,
it's an
enormous change, and the ripple effects are, you know, we see them so clearly now in hindsight, but there's no way that you know, Og and Grog sitting down saying, hey, let's put these seeds in the ground and see what happens, would realize that when this happens, you start to farm, you settle, and all of a sudden you get, you know, somebody has to be in charge of the food supply, and they have to have people to guard the food supply. And all of a sudden, if you don't do what this person says, then you don't eat. And that's, you get this powerful sort of stratification that begins to happen. So, you know, I'm thinking about these changes that are happening now. You know, everybody is suddenly working from home. Everybody is suddenly masking up when they go to the store, maybe going to this grocery store less than before, shrinking in from your neighbors. So, you know, that's well and good, and it's cute that people are starting to shake hands with their elbows and stuff. But, you know, bigger picture, what could really come from this? I mean, so, you know, my company has a huge building in San Francisco. It's home to three tech companies that, two of which at least, I think everybody would recognize. You know, the building has been empty for a month now, literally empty. No one is there. And down the street, there's people sleeping in the park because they got nowhere to go. So, you know, if there's a will here, what happens if someone says, hey, we don't need to have millions of people coming in from outside the city into the city to fill these buildings and do their work every single day? You know, maybe we need a million, but not 100 million or whatever. You know, is that a benefit? What can happen with the property? Could we repurpose some of this stuff to fix housing crisis, that sort of thing? And then I think about, well, okay, so what is in place to stop it? So what's the equivalent of the church and the nobles now, right? So you think you know, capitalism is going to let this happen? And that's kind of where I get stuck. You know, is developers and real estate people going to say, oh yeah, we don't actually need to make as much money as before? Are people who go to work every day going to say, hey, maybe we can slow down a little bit because it's totally cool to be able to work from home. And when you need to go read a lesson to your kids, it's fine to go do that. Is that something we're going to be able to hang on to? Because it seems like a benefit to me.
Well, it,
but I'm not the one making the decisions.
Right. Well, and there's an intersection here with climate change. You know,
yeah.
I read a story earlier today where people in India are actually able to see the Himalayas for the first time in some people's lives.
Wow.
That they're visible from parts of the Indian subcontinent, and no one has been able to see them because of the massive amounts of air pollution there, brought on, of course, by a lot of coal-fired power plants, by the way. But that's a different story. And you think about the number of times that culture, and the thing is, with most of them, we don't know what they look like because there was no one there to record it, because the knowledge of the how to record it was in the hands of the people who were being walked away from. And I think, you know, we think about the Mesoamerican cultures, and we know what happened in 1519 with Cortez and the conquistadors, and we know what happened to the Incas with Pizarro. But what we don't necessarily know is what happened with the Maya. The Maya were certainly there when the Spanish arrived, but they the Mayan post-classic civilization had pretty much petered out in terms of the let's build a lot of pyramids department by, what, 1300 of the Common Era? But because of climate change, they walked away. They walked away from all this magnificent grandeur. And, you know, one of the great questions of archaeology is what happened to the Harappan people along the Indus River? And we're guessing climate change or something awful with the river, but we don't have an answer. But we do know that they walked away. And how, what does that look like in medias res? What does it look like when, what does it feel like when people simply say, screw it, this isn't working anymore? And
and that's, go on.
No, I was just going to say, I'm enough of a nerd and a weirdo that when I'm in big cities, I can see them as ruins. Does that make sense?
It does. You know, it's striking that if you think about, you know, the Mayans are, you know, among the folks that you named, you know, they're still around.
Yeah.
which may speak a lot to dispersal as a strategy. So, you know, here in the Southwest, too, you
Chaco
know, the great sort of Chaco phenomenon. Yeah. So, you know, there's been a lot of work here, and people know, you know, well, the people who were at Chaco dispersed probably due to climate change, right? And they went to places like Mesa Verde, and then a lot of them ended up basically being the Pueblo today, you know? So that the walking away as a strategy is a thing that we have done, we've done. It's hard to say successfully because, I mean, what does success look like? We tend to think that the bigger the city, the more successful, right? But isn't perseverance, isn't endurance a measure of success too?
Absolutely. And, you know, I think of Faulkner. Yeah. I think of Faulkner at the end of The Sound and the Fury, of all things, when he's speaking of Dilsey's family, and after cataloging all the awful things that happened to the Compsons and everything because they were awful. Of Dilsey and her family, he says they endured. I mean, enduring is winning in some of this.
It is. Every single one of those cases had an advantage that we don't have right now, and that's contact, right? So the at the end of the day, we're just still big upright walking primates, right? And every single primate has got to have other primates around them because it's who we are. We've got to have someone to groom and someone to groom us, and we've got to have that contact and that hug every now and then. And that is, to me, what is more concerning about this. Like, yeah, it's cute that people, like I said, you know, shake hands by fist bumping, and it's cool that we can all kind of Skype or Zoom in to a meeting. But that's not enough. It's not enough for, you know, two chimps in cages where they can't touch each other. You know, that's not acceptable. That's not a way to live.
They'll lose their minds.
They will. And you know, we may not be there yet, but the fact that, you know, funeral homes aren't letting people go to funerals, that parents can't go see you know, kids, spouses when they have a baby, that sick people can't be visited. That's the hard part about this. And there's got to be a much, much better solution than just virtual meetings, as great as it is maybe for some workers. That's the concerning part to me.
I agree.
The Harappans, they stuck together wherever they went.
Well, yeah, one presumes they did. And, of course, like you said, the Mayan language is still extant. And because it's being spoken by the Mayans, they're still extant. Let me ask you this, because I know your time is short. I've hammered on it. Probably the most infuriating and frustrating aspect of all of this, outside of the social distancing and everything, is the people who seem to want the disease to persist and continue. And is there an anthropological explanation for the people in these mega churches who are being coddled and going and meeting in their thousands together and rubbing elbows and LARPing and smolicking on one another beyond simple cult behavior or just plain stupid?
Yeah, I was wondering if you meant the kids that are still playing on the playgrounds, the picket basketball games that are still happening.
Yeah, well, that too. But I mean, I worry about it more when there's 2,000 of them. Or going to the beach in their thousands.
Yeah, I would fall back onto the need for contact. You know, that we've got to be with like-minded people too. You want to be with people that are in your tribe, however you define it, right? So, when we were in little bands running around the savannah, where we all came from in East Africa, we were probably pretty good at fighting off whatever bugs were most prevalent among our close kin, or in the water holes that we went to, periodically during the year, because we were used to them, right? But as soon as you came into contact with the next band over, you got some novel disease, and people probably got sick. And there's probably something to our distrust of strangers and our desire to be close to people, from that deep memory of, boy, those people over there that are different from us, they probably got something bad, and it filters through culture, and we have stories about, Chinese eating bats and making the disease and all that bullshit. But I think when there's a crisis, your horizon shrinks, and you want to be with the people who are familiar to you, or the ones who have the same sort of outlook. And I think it's that thing where, you can't be with anyone else, but you can be with the people that you're with every Sunday, and they're familiar to you, and you got the same sort of beliefs. And it makes sense to me. It doesn't make sense, but in a bigger picture,
it's comprehensible.
The desire makes sense.
If you can't be with the one you love the one you're with, right?
You got to be with somebody.
Well, Dr. John, I really appreciate your time this evening. I sincerely do. And maybe this conversation needs to go a little further as we move along through all of this, because this is a topic that is both broad and deep, and having a greater understanding of human behavior through the long lens might prove, just by providing some perspective, it might prove helpful for some folks, sitting at home going, "This is driving me batshit." And if you can look back and say, well, this is not the first time, and other people have handled this, and we can handle it too. And hope that it plays out that way.
Hope so. And keep an eye out for these around the margins changes that can happen. I mean, I worry about, the idea that we need to, that teachers can be people who load lesson plans into virtual environments and the kids can learn from iPads. I mean, that concerns me. De-skilling workforces. What happens to, retail workers if we decide that we can all shop virtually now? There would certainly be benefits if there were fewer Walmarts in the landscape, but damn, they're the biggest employer. So people got to eat, there's a lot of facets to it, but anyway, I enjoyed talking to you. I will try not to be such a stranger in the future. But it's always a pleasure.
Oh, it's a joy, Dr. John. It's an absolute joy. And my best to everyone in your virtual workspace, and especially to your family.
Thank you. And everyone in the family here, be well, folks.
Take care. Thank you, John. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. That could have gone on for a couple of hours.
Do maybe try to stop telling us how to stop telling us how to have perspective, Bob. Yeah, okay. But it's worth understanding that what we're going through right now is not okay. We're calling it the novel coronavirus because it's a new coronavirus, but there is not novelty in plague. My God, the history of this country alone is in many ways a history of plague. And you can start with yellow fever and malaria and go from there. Typhoid. I saw a video today of mass graves being dug on a little island off of the Bronx. And that's not something any of us, I think, were ever raised to expect. And yet there were the plain pine boxes being laid into the earth and attended not by priests shaking rattles or waving incense stenchers or anything like that. No cassocks, no robes. No, they were attended by people in hazmat suits. And in 21st century America, we have a sense that we're not supposed to see that. And arguably, the great effort of a number of people who take the idea of governance seriously, has been to make sure that we don't see that. Unfortunately, the executive branch of the government, half of the legislative branch, and the entirety of the court system is controlled by people for whom that is not such a concern. And that's how we get to where we are. I mean, you can lay all of this on one doorstep. You absolutely can. So it's all worth considering. And by the way, thank you going out to our buddy Anatole. Anatole just took us down to 135 to go on the When Donnie Chooses You Loses challenge. And thank you to the maker of that challenge. Yeah, there you go. Dennis from Columbus says, COVID-19? COVID-19. Trump, a big zero. And Greg, yeah, there you are. Greg says, mass graves, Bob? Then it's official. Trumpzilla has made the U.S. a shithole country. Yeah. David in South Carolina, Stan, picking up on what Dr. John and I were talking about. The Navajo Nation, which is the largest indigenous tribal group in the country, has reported 558 total COVID-19 cases and 22 deaths, and a 57-hour curfew is set to begin. Jesus. So, and the other thing to add to this is that I read a piece at Vox by Ezra Klein in which he talked about the proposal papers for how to ease up, because of course Corona Caligula is losing his shit and wanting to reopen the country on May the 1st, when there is not a single shred of evidence that that would be anything short of psychopathically homicidal. But he has lickspittle governors, especially in the Confederacy, who will fling the doors wide open and make what we already have as a goddamn nightmare even more of one than we were otherwise imagining, or than we otherwise know to exist. Total global infection number, 1,681,964, of which nearly 500,000 are in the United States alone. Nobody's even close to us. Man, we are so number one. I mean, we got some American exceptionalism going that nobody can touch. 491,358 infections in the U.S., and the nearest to us is Spain at 157,053. They're not going to catch us because American exceptionalism. And I said you can lay it all on one doorstep. That's not entirely true. The buck stops with Donald Trump, whether he likes it or not. Donald Trump is, and I was one of the first people to say it, Donald Trump is the primary vector of the disease in the United States of America. But it's also, well, it's Fox News. It's Onan, the network that spills its news upon the ground. It's Jerry Falwell Jr. It's Kenneth Copeland. It's any. It's that, what's his name, Pastor Spellcaster in Louisiana. That South African fellow, Rodney Howard Brown in Florida. And I checked in a little bit on the early shit show today, and just watched the comments whiz by, and the number of people screaming hoax, it's not real, was both not surprising and at the same time deeply depressing. Shit. Because the more of those there are, the more we are guaranteed not to even mitigate from where we are now. And that the damn thing is just going to burn and burn and burn. Major League Baseball, for God's sakes, is floating the possibility of an abbreviated season cut into two leagues that run like that run like spring training. There'd be a cactus league and a grapefruit league, and all the games between all the teams will be played only in Florida and Arizona. Hint, they don't need to be played there either. Because even if you don't allow fans into the stands, you still wind up with the number of people it takes to put on a baseball game. And then there are the psychopaths among us. Bill O'Reilly, who declared that Well, we're overemphasizing this pandemic because, and these were his words, this is a quote, he showed up on the radio show that the Hannity job, the life support system for a haircut, has, and he said, the projections that you just mentioned are down 60,000. I don't think it'll be that high. 13,000 dead in the USA. Many people who are dying, both here and around the world, were on their last legs anyway, and I don't want to sound callous about that. Then don't say it, dick. But see, it's okay if it's okay with Bill O'Reilly if the old and the sick die, because Bill O'Reilly is a fascist. And that's how fascists roll. And when Hannity said to him that he'd catch hell for that, he said, "Well, I don't care. I mean, a simple man tells the truth." On April 1, the CDC reported that 73% of all Americans hospitalized for COVID have a pre-existing health condition that made them vulnerable to the contagion. That lines up with a study out of China that states that less than 1% of virus fatalities occur in folks with no health problems. The far left wants chaos and carnage, so President Trump will lose re-election. They're not interested in facts and will try to punish people who provide perspective. That's not perspective. That's homicidal intent. Jesus. And now he's pogo-sticked up onto the cross to claim that the far left is smearing him for saying that it's okay if we just bump off the old and sick in our culture. I loved what Dr. John said about culture. Let's not worry about defining it right now. Just take it for what it is, that we've got it. And you know, and you know how culture is transmitted? Culture is transmitted over the course of lifetimes. And if you bump off the old and the sick, your culture changes dramatically. But I guess Bill O'Reilly, who's in his 70s, Bill O'Reilly must think that maybe he's not the right kind of old people to have the coronavirus bump off. But the fact of the matter is there is an economic aspect to this. It does not strike low and high alike. It does not strike rich and poor alike. And the numbers bear that out. It's not just the old and the sick. It's the old and the sick and the poor. And that's infuriating. Because he has enough of a platform and enough of a voice. That his word will carry weight. And I mentioned the church's business to Dr. John. In Kansas, their governor there, a Democrat, Laura Kelly, did the right thing and said no church services over 10 people. And then the Kansans, the Republicans in the Kansas legislature, said, fuck her, and overrode her her rule. There was just a skeleton body of the Kansas legislature left called the Legislative Coordinating Council. And every Republican on that committee voted to overturn it, while the Democrats voted to keep the limitations in place. The Kansas City Star lit up the Republicans, saying in an editorial, "To be clear, Governor Kelly did not prohibit anyone from praying or worshiping. She simply limited mass church attendance in an effort to slow the spread of the deadly coronavirus, just as other governors across the country have done." And here's the thing, it matters. Because of the 12 clusters of outbreaks in Kansas, three of them are directly traceable, contact traceable to what? Church. The Kansas City Star continued, "As we approach the peak of this pandemic, there's no longer any question that putting a stop to large gatherings is an absolute imperative. Most Kansans understand that the only safe decision is to stay home. That Kansas lawmakers were even debating this question should deeply trouble their constituents. The governor's order was inarguably necessary and appropriately limited. 44 states, including Missouri, limit church attendance to 10 persons or fewer or no one at all. They're killers. The Republicans are fucking killers. And they pretty much don't care who they kill because they just make the illogical leap that it won't be them. Monsters. Monsters. And let's see, big thanks going out to John. Thank you, John, very kindly. We're down to 510, we're down to 110 left on the When Donnie Chooses, You Loses challenge. 110 left. Thank you very, very kindly, John. And so, with any luck, we'll continue and be able to make sure that the program stays on the air. Well, thank you, Jimmy. Jimmy says, I'll make it short and sweet. Great interview. We need more Dr. John. Horn family, stay strong. Thank you, Jimmy. Dr. John and I have been friends for a very long time, and some of our conversations are just for the ages. And I also have to thank Dr. John because while I was in Alabama, I got a care package of real deal dried New Mexico chilies of several different varieties that have proved wonder working. God, they're hot and they're wonderful. So that pretty much, that's the first hour of the program. Let's wander over to the old holler tree wherein we keep the extraordinary ordinary roundtable and check in with Sparky. Hey, Sparky.
Hey, Bob. Sorry to hear about your weather.
Oh, yeah, I can hear it in your voice how sorry you are.
I'm just sitting here surveying North Man Cave Park. Grady's out sitting by the pasture fence.
Oh, and it truly is. It looks like a park, that photo you sent.
That machine does a good job, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And, I mean, is that a walk behind or?
No, that's a riding.
Ooh. Is it one of those zero turns with the two handles, or do you have a steering wheel?
Steering wheel.
Yeah, it made it look like parkland.
And then I got a grass catcher for it. I ordered from Lowe's. And I put that on yesterday. I was cussing a few things there. Had this one part. You look at the diagram, and it doesn't fit where it shows it. And I don't know. I said, fuck it. I'll leave it off.
So far, so good.
Yeah, it really sucks. I mean, I did the front lawn. It's amazing how much stuff I got off of it. The main reason I was thinking, I'm getting old. I don't want to rake leaves anymore.
You know, that could be the front end of a hell of a good compost pile. All those clippings.
Oh, yeah.
That could be awesome for your tomatoes.
I'm not going to use the back part. If you hear that noise, the kid's running a four-wheeler next door.
Oh, I thought maybe my next-door neighbors had made it out to your place.
Well, they got a little track out there. Their lot is about as big as mine, but he's got him a track out there. Friend of his came over too. I'm staying away from the neighbors. They're not practicing real good social distancing.
Yeah, I'd say that's probably a wise choice on your part.
Having too many people over. And plus, there's too many of them besides just me and Judy and Grady. That's the way I want it. I went out today and I got lucky, scored some toilet paper. Per unit Dollar General and some paper towels.
Ooh, that's a win.
But then go to the main grocery store and the shelves are still empty.
Yeah, what,
and they were
what
out of milk and eggs.
What Steve in New York said about checking the smaller stores, I think, is true. Because everybody assumes that the big stores get more supplies more often. Oh, and by the way, I tried, I didn't mean to, but Agnes opened up, I got a couple of cartons of that cardboard box milk that just sits on the shelf with the canned milk. That stuff's really good. You know, it's just super, super pasteurized so that, you know, it keeps for eons. And I'd set it back, but Agnes thought we were out, and so she opened one up, and I said, oh, yeah. Because I never much cared for the taste of, like, dry milk and, you know, powdered milk, and canned milk doesn't taste like milk. This stuff just tastes like milk, and it's really, really good.
Well, Dollar General had a lot of eggs, but my main grocery store had eggs and milk. But my main grocery store, it was like a zoo in there today. City of masks. Everybody had different color masks. And
he sounds like he's having fun.
Well, he's got his buddy on it now.
Don't roll that thing, son. Well,
they got like a figure eight track out there.
Oh, nice. Is Billable Rick with us?
I don't think so.
I mean, I see him there, and he's got a green dot.
Oh, okay. Maybe. He wasn't there when I first made the call.
Apparently, he liked the last great Easter joke.
Yeah, we got...
He may be doing billable stuff.
Hey, how you doing?
Oh, there he is. You found the mute button.
Yeah, well, actually, I was listening to you on my smartphone. I'm trying to get a thing filed today, but how's everybody doing?
Oh, pretty good. I mean, and that's some heady work, that thing filing. I understand.
Tax court, actually. Tax court petition. So it's got to be sent out by certified mail. I just printed everything out. All I need to sign the stuff. So,
well, I'm glad you enjoyed the last great Easter joke.
Oh, I loved it. It was funny as hell. I think I heard you tell it once before, but you tell it really with quite the flourish today, I must say.
Well,
not that you don't normally, but you know. Extra special flourish. Maybe it's because of all the time you've had to think about things sitting around quarantined, you know?
Just another day. I mean,
yeah.
It's kind of like what Dr. John was talking about. Isolation's sort of a thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I'm less isolated than most people because I'm somehow considered to be an essential worker because, I'm necessary for legal and legal compliance and so forth, legal and accounting compliance. So they've designated attorneys, I guess, as essential workers. Don't ask me why. I don't know if I agree with that, but anyway, for whatever reason, I'm still working, which is good, you know?
So are you having to go into the office and stuff?
Yeah, there's only a total of three of us here in the office, and we all have you know, the receptionist has her area near the front door, a big area, and then my boss is down at the other end of the hallway, and I got my own office. So here, I can take my mask off, I think. there's a new rule in place here that if you're an essential worker, you got to wear a mask at all times at work. But I figure if my door is closed, I don't have to wear it, you know. Plus, one has to be able to eat as well, you know. Kind of hard to with a mask. So I got myself some chili that I'll be having pretty soon. So, but yeah, I mean, I pretty much I'm hunkered down at Stars. My son doesn't want me to be coming back to the house. So it's like, okay, either you stay at the house or you stay with Star. You don't like stay with Star just on weekends and then come home during the week. It's like, not, you have to either do one or the other. It's not his house, but he's concerned and he's back. He's out of college. Well, he's actually in college. He's taking online courses now at UC Irvine. I mean, they, like everybody else, shut down about a month ago. So I helped him move out of his room And they actually let the students terminate the leases early and did not penalize them as far as financial aid goes. Because they obviously, if they're living at home, they don't have the same expenses. But at least for this, the rest of the year here, they're not penalizing them, which is good. So,
well, that's the kind of merciful thing you can expect from responsive, decent governance. You know, the stuff that so many of us don't have.
Well, actually, this came from the Department of Education because it was like the federal student aid program, you know. And, initially the students were told that if they terminated their leases early, that might affect their financial aid award. And so they realized, oh, wait a second, we better not do this because we want to get people the hell off of campus. We don't want to have a disincentive for them to we don't want to incentivize them to stay on campus. We want them to leave because, you know, all the services are closed. There's no in-person classes. I mean, it wouldn't make any sense to learn remotely, to take remote courses from an an adjacent campus apartment, you know?
Yeah.
What sense would that make?
And meanwhile, 1,800 students returned to Falwell University?
And, oh, my God. Seriously?
And now they've got the coronavirus running around that Falwell is so certain is a hoax.
Well, all I can say is the Darwin Award is alive and well in this country. You know, there's lots of people who are deciding to, self-naturally select, if you want to call it that,
Yeah, but as I've said before, there's no way of making sure that it stays that way.
I know. That's the problem. Yeah. Right, because it's these yahoos that will, they're part of the herd, unfortunately. We'd like to think they weren't part of the herd, but they are part of the herd. And anything that, somebody does that's irresponsible can affect the members of the herd that are actually normal and behaving.
They're the paste-eating part of the herd, Rick.
the glue-sniffing part of the herd, right?
Jesus. I got to send out some thank yous to, thank you very kindly to Jeremy in Vermont. We're now half done with the When Donnie Chooses, You Loses challenge. $100 to go on that. Thank you very kindly, Jeremy. And Jeremy reminded us along the way, checking in from Vermont, we now have in little itsy-bitsy, teeny-tiny Vermont, 679 cases and 23 deaths, with an expected 1,000 to 5,000 to be confirmed by our peak. And today, Governor Phil Scott gave new guidance and extended our lockdown till May 15th and warned even after that we will not be opening everything back up all at once, hopefully not creating a spike in doing so. I know everybody wants to go out and run around and life return to normal and everything, but teasing yourself into thinking that something's miraculously going to happen at mid-May even. See, these lockdowns are being extended by fits and starts because nobody in government wants to freak people out. Like I said last night, Ralph Northam in Virginia is the only one who just stood up, and he's a doctor, of course, and said, fuck it, we're done till June.
Is it through June or just the beginning of June?
It's like June 12th or something, I think.
Okay.
Maybe June 9th, I'm not sure, but it's June.
Mm-hmm.
And that's reasonable and rational, but that doesn't even fully anticipate the breadth and scope of what we're dealing with. And part of the reason is, and I highly recommend to anybody to go and read the Vox article by Ezra Klein, who read the three different studies. One was Harvard, another was the American Enterprise Institute, and the other was the Center for American Progress. Three different academic plans or, think tank plans for how to restart things. And as he points out, none of them are good. And some of them are downright terrifying because another thing that goes with that is that today there was a big announcement that Apple and Google, who are constantly at each other's throats, have agreed to work with each other on a contact tracing app. The problem is who gets the data and who gets to use the data? How transparent is the data? Because, see, they did this in China, which, of course, is an authoritarian clamp-down culture. government, and you have to show your your phone everywhere you go, and so that government is literally tracking the movement of every one of its nearly 1.5 billion citizens. And that ain't good. And that's kind of what is being thought of for here. But knowing what we know about Corona Caligula, he's just going to want to fling the doors wide. Because, like Bill O'Reilly, he doesn't really give a shit how many people die as long as it isn't him. As long as he doesn't get it, he's good.
So, Bob, that doesn't seem to be a very rational position to take if his goal is to win re-election, except to the extent that a second, third wave could be used as a rationale to not even have the election in November.
Well, back
that would be
back,
the only rational aspect of it.
Back up, though. He does not have the power to do that.
Well, yeah, that's true. I guess it's up to the individual states to decide what they're going to do with regard to the method and manner of choosing
electors. And the Congress. And the Congress.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
His term of office is over on January 20th, 2021, and there's not a goddamn thing he can do about it. And so is Mike Pence's. But unfortunately, so is Nancy Pelosi's.
Well, Nancy's actually ends earlier. The new Congress gets
correct.
New Congress gets sworn in before.
But if there is no election, we have two-thirds of the Senate still in office.
Yep.
But Trump is gone. And there's no constitutional number for anybody in the Senate to take over as the head of state.
Mm. Well, I mean, actually, there's a succession. It goes president, vice president, speaker of the House, president pro tem of the Senate.
Oh, okay, so president pro tem of the Senate, they could, the two-thirds that are left could create a president pro tem, and that person would become president.
Well, I mean,
Chinless Mitch. Well, actually, no, his term ends, too.
Chinless Mitch is gone.
Yeah, he's gone. Yeah.
And there were more Republicans up for their terms were up this time around than Democrats. So the two-thirds that would be left would be a Democratic majority.
Okay. I could live with that.
Somebody investigated that before, and they said Leahy would become the president.
Yeah, well...
He's the longest term senator, I guess.
But if the Senate knew that they were actually electing the president of the United States, they may not go with the historic tradition of the longest serving member of the dominant party becoming the president pro tem.
So would it be Schumer then?
No.
Well, it could be anybody. The majority of that two-thirds that's left elects to be president pro tem.
I don't think there's any basis for the remaining senators to have an election to decide who becomes president. That's the thing.
It'll be Bernie.
It won't be Bernie. They wouldn't have the constitutional authority to organize.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
So it would have to be Leahy, Mr. Leahy. The trailer park boys, that is.
You've got to understand what the president pro tem is. It's not, by tradition, it's the oldest member of the ruling party. But what he is the president pro tempore, which means the president for the time being, because the vice president is the president of the Senate. But by tradition, the vice president doesn't go and sit in every session. And so the president pro tempore, the president pro tem, is whomever they designate. Generally speaking, it is the most senior senator, but on any given day, it's whomever the majority leader designates, and that's why senators, when they get wrought up, Mr. Speaker, I must stand up and object, because whoever's got the gavel is the president pro tem.
Right, it's true. They trade that around.
So, yeah.
Anyhow, can we go for a big gear shift?
Yeah.
Okay. A couple of nights ago, there was some discussion about the vape cigarette number.
Yeah.
And the cartridge is coming from China. Did a little research on it, and apparently a lot of the vape cartridges were fortified with a vitamin E oil.
Yes.
And that vitamin E oil was what was getting into the lungs and clogging them up.
Yeah, that stuff, I think, yeah, and I think Todd in South Carolina Stan pointed that out at the time, too. But,
well, maybe I missed that part.
Well, no. I don't think I read it. I think I just saw where he messaged me. Yeah, it was the vitamin E oil. And it could be that part of the reason that we're having different numbers here in terms of how it's affecting younger people is the degree to which vaping became a craze and was so eagerly adopted by so many young people, and they weakened their lungs.
Well, it was just that it was kind of brought out that the cartridges are made in China, and who knows when this virus was first created or found out or transferred or jumped from bats to people or whatever, and could that possibly have
right.
been part of the vaping experience of getting COVID-19? And so anyhow, there was a discussion about it. We really weren't sure what the vaping illness was. And I'm saying, I just, from all the research I've done and from two different sources that nailed me on my little post on Facebook, that vitamin E oil appears to be the ultimate culprit.
Yes.
That's all.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I don't know what to make of the business about the DIA assessment warning, whatever we want to call it. Of something taking place in November. As far as I'm concerned, it's just another element of proof, another fact point about how unseriously this was taken, or how much deliberate and willful indifference was shown to human life. But that's like saying that the monster's really, really scary instead of just saying the monster's really scary.
Okay, I'll do another quantum leap. Apparently, one of the admirals in the Navy has thoroughly confirmed that there is an investigation ongoing, and that Captain Crozier may well get his command back if the investigation points to the fact that he, in fact, did nothing wrong but try to save the lives of the military people under him in his command. So I thought that was kind of a nice big slap at the ex-acting Secretary of the Navy.
Yeah, the infection rate now is up to 400 people on that ship.
Including the captain.
Well, yeah.
And arguably based on previous lockdowns before the Teddy Roosevelt stuff's even started, it's probably in the rest, to some degree or another, it's in the rest of the fleet.
Well,
some portion of the rest of the fleet.
Especially if they had port calls.
Well, their last port of call before Guam was Vietnam. Now, I don't know the port call before that one. But since they're tied up at the Naval Station Guam, which I spent 19 and a half months living on, it's bound that some of that crew, well, I don't know, were they under a quasi-quarantine at the time they docked?
That's what I was saying. It was weeks ago now that the Navy ordered its ships to remain at sea and quarantine. And so then, I guess after that, they lifted it. That somehow or another, the Teddy Roosevelt carrier group winds up in, you know,
now stake Guam. The problem that I'm having, well, that Vietnam was a humanitarian goodwill gesture, and the crew of the Teddy Roosevelt went ashore and helped build infrastructure. So there was a fair amount of intermingling with the people of Vietnam. But my point is, I'm curious as to whether or not the crew of the Teddy Roosevelt was in fact under quarantine when they tied up, and the rest of the carrier group, when they tied up in Guam. Because if they were not in, there's one EM club, enlisted man's club, on Guam called the Club Macombo. And if they went there, it went through the barracks, which is right across the street, which goes to the Chow Hall, which is in the barracks complex, which goes to the PX and the commissary. And then the Navy people went up to Anderson Air Force Base, because if you wanted fresh vegetables, you went to the Air Force Base. If you wanted frozen stuff, you went to the Navy base because of the transportation number. So I haven't seen any numbers from Anderson Air Force Base or the Naval Air Station or on the Navy station itself what any of the infection rates are. I know Guam does have them in the civilian population.
I think they're locked down, but the tourist, you know, and in Gagne, all the big hotels.
Yeah.
I think they put up like 1,000 of the sailors in them.
There's something like 2,000 of the sailors staying in those hotels.
Oh, okay.
The ones that tested negative were taken off to the hotels, and the ones that tested positive, I believe, either went to the Naval Hospital or stayed on board the Teddy Roosevelt.
Yeah.
Now, Sailor Chick just posted in the chat room that there was no Navy fleet-wide quarantine when the TR pulled into Vietnam.
Okay, so that was before they announced it. Okay.
Anyhow, if anybody walked into the EM Club on Guam or went to the walk-in outdoor movie theater on the Navy base, the quarters are so close that it made it onto the base. And if it's made it onto the base, there's just basically no way to get rid of it until everybody gets sick.
Well, I'd feel ever so much better about all of this if we had someone competent in charge, but that's just, you know.
Well, I think there are some competent people in charge, but they're not willing to speak out against the orange turd that's in the top.
Well, I'm talking about the commander in chief, Roger. I mean,
yeah, but that admiral that said they are opening an investigation. It has begun, and if in fact Captain Crozier did nothing wrong, it's possible he will get his command back. So that's, to me, a competent admiral. I think the one that was, I wrote you the other night, the one that should have his ass in the ringer is the admiral that was on board the aircraft carrier that was the CO of the entire carrier group, because he was Crozier's immediate commander. And he's the one that didn't do squat.
Completely agree with that, Roger. Did everyone see all these crazy stories going around? One of them is that 5G caused the coronavirus.
Oh, no, I'm looking at that story right now, Christopher.
Can you believe it?
No, well, it's not. And I talked about this earlier in the week. It's a British phenomenon. And, you know, they've got crazy and stupid just like we do, too. And we pretty much probably know how they vote. But they've taken to setting fire to 5G cell towers because they've decided in the thin gray settlings that pass for their brains that 5G causes your body to be susceptible to the Rona. And so over the last week or so, there have been more than 30 acts of arson and vandalism to take down 5G wireless towers.
Oh, my God.
Plus, could somebody tell me how you can tell the difference between a 5G tower and a 4G tower?
Well, it doesn't. That's a very logical question to ask. But the thing is, this goes back to the orange shithead throwing a fit and telling Great Britain not to deploy 5G that was manufactured by Huawei, a Chinese telecom. Okay, and so the idiots have began to declare that 5G Wi-Fi it gives you the Rona.
Yeah, I guess the 5G towers.
It's made worse. There have been 80 other, on top of the 30 acts of arson and vandalism, there have been 80 more incidents as well. And among other things, John Cusack and Woody Harrelson have linked 5G to the coronavirus.
Yeah, I guess the 5G towers must have opposable thumbs.
Are they friends of Gwyneth by chance?
Those and Jill Stein. Jill Stein's definitely behind this.
Jeez. What morons.
Well, Britain's got virus like we do.
The New York Times did kind of a deep dive on it. They found 487 Facebook communities, 84 Instagram accounts, 52 Twitter accounts, all pushing the 5G gives you the Rona paranoia. An Instagram network of some 40 accounts has 58,800 followers.
How does electromagnetic radiation affect a virus, Bob? Unless it's like a certain temperature,
oh God,
like about 58 degrees Celsius.
No, you have to go so far down the crazy rabbit hole here. Here's how it goes. In the UK, they issued the shelter-in-place order on March 23rd. And the goobers said, well, this is a secret trick to make us all stay home while they build their secret 5G masts without us being able to see. And one of the first incidents was in Belfast in Northern Ireland on April 2nd. God damn.
Are the for these areas of the UK, I imagine a lot the followers of this theology probably fly the, you know, Confederate flag quite regularly, I imagine, huh?
Well, you know, I don't get the notion that John Cusack and Woody Harrelson are those types of folks.
No, no.
But
maybe Woody's smoking too much.
You know.
He is quarantined right now, so what else does he have to do, right?
Well, setting ablaze to stuff and lighting bombs in Belfast, that, you know, what could go wrong there?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
Jeez.
Well, plus they can blame the Chinese as well. That fits in with the whole thing about it being a Chinese virus, right?
It's an egg foo young.
Yeah. Right. Jeez. Ignorance. The stupid is very strong in those people.
It's strong all over deadly. The world.
Yeah. It's deadly stupid.
Oh, no doubt. Yeah.
Hey, I just saw Steve wandered in New York.
Yeah, I'm just kind of hanging out. I'm still finishing some work. I was thinking we ought to start a rumor that COVID-19 causes the coronavirus. Listen, you know that would fly because these are the same nutballs who say they prefer the Affordable Care Act over Obamacare.
Yes, right, yeah.
Or I saw a thing one time where these guys put a a table out in, like in a foot mall or something, and they were talking about ending the suffrage of women around the world, and they wanted people to sign the petition to end the suffrage of women. And everyone was signing it, and this one woman goes up, she says, "No, that is the right to vote." And of course, people thought it meant the suffering of women, but yeah. But I think we ought to start that we think that the COVID-19 is what's causing the coronavirus.
That's like when who was it, Penn and Teller, you know, because they're big libertarians and, you know, goofy, silly, stupid liberals. They went to some environmental rally with a petition and walked around and asked people to sign their petition if they thought that the chemical dihydrous oxide should be regulated. And, of course, they got lots of video of people going, "Oh, yeah, definitely. Oh, yeah, chemicals. You know, water."
Well, at the present time, water is fairly well regulated. Trump hasn't gotten totally rid of the Environmental Protection Agency yet.
He's put a nice dent in it.
Well, yeah, and he's allowing the chemical companies to dump more shit into it, but still, your municipal water is still regulated by regulations having to tell you how much shit's in it.
Sure, but in the case of Penn and Teller, it was thousands of people die every year because of exposure to dihydrous oxide, you know, drowning.
By the way, not to be the science nerd, but it's dihydrogen monoxide.
Okay, I was.
No, yeah. 1-0.
Right. Yeah.
Well, we do have those little floating. What are they? Those little plastic beads that are, you know, all over the planet in the water, wreaking havoc.
Yeah, microplastics.
You're talking about microplastics.
Yes, that's it.
Oh, and by the way, as far as 5G towers are concerned, Jeremy tells us, as far as I've read, they're much smaller and many more because 5G doesn't travel as far as 4 or 3. So you got to put up more of them.
Mm. More of them to burn.
Yeah, no kidding. Let's see. Jack,
what's the latest on Bojo?
Asks, do you think Woody might go so far as to inject bad propaganda into the mix in order to try to prevent more towers from being installed since they mess up the environment? Kind of hard to guess, but wouldn't be surprised. Really can't even take a run at that. James in Illinois says, Woody in quarantine, maybe he's not smoking enough.
Well, it has been designated an essential business in California, you know, the pot shops. So,
yeah,
you know, he can run out and get more if he runs out.
Oregon, too.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. I think throughout the country, many states have designated it as such.
Well, so, I'm sure Colorado.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did I tell you they deliver to Red Bluff now?
Do they? Nice.
Yeah,
if they close the pot shops, they better close liquor stores.
Oh, no. Don't you say that.
You have to have a minimum order for them to deliver, and they don't deliver after 5:30.
Okay. Yeah. liquor stores, their consumption's way up of liquor. Jeez. As is domestic violence, unfortunately.
Well, my understanding is that the actual per capita consumption hasn't changed all that much because you have to take into account all that which was consumed in drinking establishments that are no longer serving.
Okay. Okay.
So a lot of your breweries are running out of cans and bottles, but the kegs aren't going anywhere.
Mm.
Yeah. That's like the toilet paper story. Did you hear about that?
Yeah.
There's more people are staying at home there using the toilet paper at work.
And the commercial toilet paper comes from different factories.
Yeah.
You could feel the difference.
Yeah, and yeah, the commercial toilet paper is made in the same factory where they make crepe paper and sandpaper.
Right, exactly.
Well, the other one is the giant rolls.
You need a shiny hiney after using that stuff. You get so sore.
21 days without using toilet paper.
The toilet paper challenge. Are you going to keep going to like extend your record or not?
Spark. I'm just going to keep going. I'm going to keep going.
Sparky,
you know what? You know what, Sparky? You should just sort of join alongside John Bridavo on this. You know, John's not going to shave until Trump's gone. And you can just keep on not using toilet paper until Trump's gone.
Or until COVID is gone.
Or both.
Yeah.
Hey, Sparky, why don't you call Guinness Book? Guinness Book of Records.
Are you kidding me?
There's Sparky's.
Are you
there's Sparky's face in the Guinness Book of World's Record. With
I can almost guarantee you that there are some people in South America that have never used a piece of toilet paper in their entire life. And there are some people in Brazil that have never used a piece of toilet paper.
Okay.
We could probably go further and say that over the vast scope of human history, it is only a minuscule percentage of humans who have lived on this planet who have ever used toilet paper. Think about that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Was it old? Was it ancient Indian civilizations that used dogs? Did I hear that? Is that wrong? Dogs.
Dogs to wipe on?
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Bend over and use the dog. Yeah. I heard something.
Run,
like that.
Grady!
I wasn't going to do that.
I'm giving myself a cowbell for that.
Yeah, that's good.
The only time he comes into the bathroom with me is when there's a thunderstorm.
It's because he ain't no dummy.
That long tail would work great.
Now, you just stop.
It's all about the dog.
Who started it?
It wasn't me.
I wonder if cat tails would work.
Yeah, you get the cat to cooperate.
No, I think he's talking about the things that were.
I don't know. George Abbott, but they saw them both wiping their butts on the carpet. So
there was a stupid video I saw on Facebook. This guy made a wall out of toilet paper, and the cat, you know, one row, and the cat would jump over it. Two rolls, cat jump over it. I mean, he kept building the wall. Finally, what cat said, fuck it, ran right through the wall.
Well, Jeremy's trying your experiment, Steve. He just posted, this is how easy it is to start a conspiracy theory. I've heard people saying COVID-19 causes coronavirus.
Hey, everybody, this is John from Pennsylvania. I don't know if you remember me.
Hey, John, how are you?
Good. How are you doing? I'm sorry I haven't been able to call in for a while because, I mean, I work up a bad night shift kind of thing. So, but yeah, you know what? It's funny because, like, it's actually backwards. COVID-19 is the disease. SARS-2 is the virus that causes the disease. So, it's backwards. But anyway, real quick, man, I just wanted to tell everybody something that just been bothering me lately. After the 2020 primary season, I'm seeing a lot of people that Bob used to call them sparkle fart powered unicorn cavalry purity brigade. I think was the thing that used to call them.
Yeah.
And I'm not trying to begrudge anybody, vote for whoever you think you want to vote for, whoever is going to, whatever, floats your boat or whatever. I'm not begrudging people for not voting for Biden. Okay. I'm not, but people that have platforms need to get better at politics, because I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about certain lefty YouTubers that spent the entire primary season attacking Elizabeth Warren. And it was like a tick. It's like they couldn't help themselves. They just did it over and over.
I know exactly what you're talking about. And that's why I took the position that I took, because A, I didn't get to vote till May. So, it was really, we had to, like it or not, we had to trust people in Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Nevada, and they all answered resoundingly, well, especially once we got to South Carolina, it was a big uh-uh to Bernie. And yeah, I don't,
right.
I'm not, and then Super Tuesday, that was curb stomping. That's what that was. But you got to understand, John, I'm sorry. I don't mean to interrupt, but just let me, part of this has to do with the fact, I think, that some of those hyper partisans cannot drill down deep enough to realize that if Bernie was not the nominee, it's not because anybody did anything to him. It's because these hyper partisans, did such a shitty job of trying to convince other people to vote for Bernie. If a political campaign fails, it fails in part because of the candidate, but in large part because of the people who support the candidate. We would have Bernie as a nominee if Bernie's campaign had done a better job. That's the and that's not just Bernie. Yeah. That's the story of all campaigns. I mean, if you can excoriate Hillary Clinton for not spending enough time in Michigan and Wisconsin in 2016, well, that's saying that it's on her and it's on her campaign, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that's why she lost those states.
Yeah, I mean.
Well, why does that logic not apply to any other losing candidate?
You're right.
Bob?
Yep. You know,
Bob?
Yeah.
I disagree. And I'll tell you why I disagree. The general election is different. There's not a party apparatus. I am not one of the, I was a Bernie person. I frankly don't like Biden, but I'll vote for him. But I think in a primary, that's only part of it. And the thing that really bugged me about this is this has Obama's hands, fingers and greasy hands all over it, with convince and this notion of, well, Biden didn't have any campaign. He didn't have any money. He didn't have any advertisements. That's irrelevant here. The fact of the matter is this. And this part is on Bernie, the whole Clyburn issue. Bernie should have at least reached out to the guy and he may have stayed neutral, number one. Number two, when Obama inserted himself into this and got Klobuchar and Buttigieg and all these other people to drop out and endorse Biden the day before, that was orchestrated.
How do you know Obama was the one behind that, Steve?
Because that's the news reports were that he called Buttigieg and said, look, this is it. Your highest amount of leverage is right now. And I don't have a problem in and of itself of Obama doing that. Politics is about maneuvering. It's about, you know, it's Machiavellian. But be honest about it. That was my big issue about that.
Well,
and
let me propose an alternative theory, if I may, Steve. Some of the say whatever you will about Biden himself, some of the most astute political operatives in Democratic Party politics were in his campaign. Okay, most of the other campaigns were running on outliers or leftovers. The machine went to work for Biden, and I'm so disattuned to anything that smacks of conspiracy, and I'm not excoriating you by using that term. But what if they knew? What if some of the most profoundly talented operatives in the Democratic Party knew? And I'm just going to throw some crazy things out there. What if they knew that African American voters are the beating heart of the Democratic Party? What if they knew that? And what if they knew
that there weren't many African-American voters in Iowa and New Hampshire. And so what if they focus their efforts on the core of the party? Because nobody did anything, you know, there was no big pullout of candidates. I mean, a few had fallen along the wayside before South Carolina. But Bernie campaigned hard in South Carolina. And he got, I mean, he didn't lose 51-49.
I understand.
He got his guts stomped out by the core of the party.
30-point loss.
No, I'm not saying. Please understand, I'm not blaming the quote-unquote establishment for what happened to Bernie, particularly in South Carolina. I put that on him, and I put that on I don't think the campaign was run as well this time as it was in 2016. I put that on him. But what happened in Super Tuesday, I don't put entirely on him, because somebody put their finger on the scales. And again, I don't have a problem with that. But be honest about it. Don't be surreptitious about it. Don't be behind the scenes about it. The other thing, too, is, I mean, I've actually said this. I think we should get rid of primaries altogether. If that were the case, then, you know, it probably would have ended up. It may have ended up that way anyway.
I think there's something significant in what you say there. It would be interesting to look at the polling data before Amy and Pete pulled out. I mean, was Amy Klobuchar really, really going to change the outcome in Texas?
No, but that's when he had Beto come in, and he had Amy ahead. Minnesota was part of Super Tuesday. She was ahead in Minnesota. Listen, right, please, let me reiterate. I don't have a problem with that.
Bernie still loses.
I understand that. I don't have a problem with putting your finger on the scale, but be honest about it. And I think, I'm not absolving Bernie. What I'm saying is let's just be honest about it. Let's be honest that Obama and probably a number of people up at the top engineered this.
Well, let me step in here for just a second. Many, many years ago, there was a faction of the Democratic Party called Blue Dog Democrats.
I know, and you know, you have the Yellow Dog Democrats.
Well, let's stay with the Blue Dogs for a minute. And after Reagan, when the union started getting tamped down, Bill Clinton and that crowd created the Democratic Leadership Council that started gathering money from the corporate sector. And that corporate sector has basically taken over the Democratic Party. And the leadership of the Democratic Party has been DLC Democrats for quite some time. Now, Bernie Sanders scares the shit out of those people. Joe Biden is a member of that crowd. So if they did not want to see an FDR-style revolution, because the DLC had moved and the Blue Dogs had moved the Democratic Party away from FDR, they don't want to see it go back to FDR because they are part of the corporate establishment. So it makes absolute sense that Obama and Bill and Hillary and Tom Perez and a whole bunch of other, I mean, you could even put Kamala Harris in that same ballpark, along with Nancy Pelosi. These are all outcomes of the Blue Dog Democrats and the DLC coalition that have moved the Democratic Party into a moderate right-wing party, had it been Europe, as opposed to the Social Democrats, which would be the left-wing party. They give lip service to the idea they're left-wing, but their actual down in dirty is just not as badly corporate as the Republicans, and hoping that labor and the people that need democratic socialism in this country will vote for them as the lesser of the evils. Which brings me to, if you're given a choice between Republican and Republican light, the Republican is going to win. And this is where I think the Democratic Party has fallen down.
Well, but, you know, we granted Perot was part of that mix, but America had a choice between a Republican and Republican light in 1992, and the Republican didn't win. I mean, there's a whole lot of Bill Clinton's presidency that is arguably just an extension of George H.W. Bush's presidency. Most favored trade, most favored nation trading permanent status for China. The Telecommunications Act. Getting rid of Glass-Steagall. It's all there.
Graham Leach Bliley.
I tend to apply Occam's razor to this stuff. Because I just can't see the core of the Democratic Party in South Carolina really wanting to know what some asshole from Wall Street thought. And, you know, the whole reason for the DLC to begin with was because the Democrats couldn't compete with the money the Republicans had. And they wanted some of it. And that's the origins of the DLC. It was a fairly recent vintage. That goes back to the, you know, it is an after effect of the stomping of Walter Mondale and Michael Dukakis. So I tend to go with that, you know, Occam's razor. The simplest answer tends to be the most likely correct one, and that was that the core of the Democratic Party didn't want Bernie. And that takes me back to my initial thesis. Why didn't they want Bernie? Well, that's on Bernie, and that's on Bernie's campaign. And,
Bob,
and just one last thing.
Sorry.
In the last 2 weeks, I saw one of the most revolting things that doesn't involve a Republican in my modern political experience. And that was a bunch of burners going out of their way to shit on John Lewis. A, the man has cancer. B, the man has stood up when it mattered and put his own blood and own life on the line. And I don't care what you believe, you don't shit on somebody like that. It's the functional equivalent of Donald Trump shitting on John McCain. Only more so. And that is unforgivable. And it wasn't just led by some random burner in the basement. It was out of the center of his campaign. And I mean, I've met John Lewis. A young woman that I dated for a time was one of his. The first time he ran for Congress in Atlanta, She was one of his most trusted aides. So I got to know him a little bit. And that man is who he says he is. And he's walked the walk, and he's talked the talk at the same time. My God, he got spat on by teabaggers back in 2010. And a bunch of people who think that history began with their awakening to politics have the nerve to crap all over him? Mm-mm, no, no, no.
See, John Aramosa and Cliff Schechter have been hammering on this point throughout their podcast about the burners. And they said, you know, that they like Bernie's policies. They even kind of like Bernie, although they've been kind of beaten up on Bernie himself. But the burners, off the rail burners, like you said, bad-mouthing John Lewis, they can't tolerate it anymore and tolerate it. And they've been, on their podcast, beaten the hell out of him.
You know what?
There was just
such... I'm sorry, that's just bull. That's bull.
What?
That's complete bull. And I'm not saying the thing about John Lewis, but Schechter and Aravosis. You know, fuck both of them. And I'll tell you why I say that. These are Hillary bots right there. They were all for Hillary. Hillary, who had her Puma movement. Ira, go back in 2008 and see the just ugliness.
I remember it well.
I mean, that is far worse than any Bernie bro had ever done. But far worse.
In the final analysis, Steve, you know, I am who I am and who I have been. I was talking about Medicare for All when I first came back to radio and had never even heard of Bernie Sanders. But I had heard of John Conyers, who was talking about it and introduced a Medicare for All bill every session. And I heard of Dennis Kucinich, who in 2004 completely reframed the Democratic presidential primary by talking about the desperate need for everybody to be able to go to the doctor when they're sick. Okay? Back then, I think Bernie was still in the House along with Dennis. And I, as I've said so many times before, I was raised by people who sat around radios listening to FDR. Okay? And so that is the mother's milk that I suckled from infancy forward. That is what I was raised on. I was raised on the New Deal, and then I was raised on the Great Society. It's so troubling to me that while I was loud and noisy for him in 2016, but when it began to resemble a cult more than a political movement, I had to take a breath because, as I've said so many times before, I don't worship anyone or anything. Not even Bernie. And it became too worshipful for me. And that becomes worrisome. And I don't know what he was thinking when he hired somebody to handle his comms who proudly boasted of having voted for Jill Stein. I still can't get my head around that.
The Bernie movement was starting to get a little maggoty. Really was.
I don't know. I completely disagree. To me, politics is a blood sport, and you win any way you can.
Yeah, but that's not a way to win, Steve. That's a way to lose.
Well, I mean, who knows what the strategy is. And again, I'm going to go back to what you said. About, you're talking about South Carolina. That was well before Super Tuesday.
Couple of weeks.
It was when Obama put his finger on the scale in Super Tuesday is what ended it. And like I said, I think we ought to just get rid of primaries. I don't know why we have
primaries. Well, I'm the one who was arguing for a one-day national primary.
I don't think there should be primaries at all.
So how's the candidate chosen then, Steve?
You do it by a convention. Why the public has to pay for two private clubs to nominate a candidate is beyond me.
Well, why? We're
back to the small field room then. If you had a convention,
but it's honest. At least it's honest. Everyone knows what's going to happen.
No, it's not. It's behind.
Sure, it is. Which is exactly what happens anyway.
No, the one positive for what you're talking about, Steve, is that we would stop bowing and scraping before the altar of the independents. You don't have to pay to join a political party. You don't have to be initiated by riding a goat, okay? There's nothing complicated about it. You pick the one you like, you sign on, groovy. And then if you want to have a say in who the nominee is, you've got a say in who the nominee is. But I remain open. Primaries remain something that is, as Jimmy Buffett once said, it's like the boogaloo. It plum evades me. Why should somebody who doesn't have the gumption to choose column A or column B get to choose my nominee?
Hey, Bob, you want me to answer that question?
Well, I mean, I know what the answer is, but go ahead.
Well, what's the answer? What do you think my answer is going to be?
I know what the stock answer is. What's yours?
My answer is, if you're asking anybody you're asking to fund with their tax dollars an election like that, how can you constitutionally
say to that person, the thing you're funding, you can't participate in.
So then every primary should be open and fucked up like Alabama's, Mississippi's, and South Carolina's, where Republicans can go
in California. Vote.
Yeah, well, y'all, it's a little different for y'all because you got a jungle primary.
What I'm saying is get rid of them. Because if they're going to be publicly financed, if they're going to be publicly financed, why only these two parties?
Because and the only reason past the post system.
No, it's not because it's a first past the post system. It's only these two parties because they control the legislature and the money.
That's not entirely true, Steve. Because
sure it is. Why don't we publicly fund the Greens and the Communists and the Pastafarians?
They get public funding if they can get to the X percentage threshold of votes received.
Don't forget the Tiger Boy.
Where in the Constitution does it say anything that you get free speech as long as you get past a certain threshold?
I think we're getting a little off to the weeds here, and I'd like to try to bring it back. In California, and that's the only state I can talk about, I'm beginning to learn a little bit about Oregon. The traditional June primary election was also city council, municipal judges, school boards. All your local elections were held at that time. Also on that ballot was the primary. And this is back when it was a closed primary. So you either said you were Republican, Independent, Democrat, whatever, Peace and Freedom. And you got the same ballot, down ballot, but you were choosing your party's nominee for an office for an election to be held in the future. And the primary election was not simply a state-funded poll of party members for a future election. It was your municipal elections, and they tacked on the political primaries.
I disagree with that as a matter of principle.
Why? What?
Why should that be publicly funded? And why?
Wait a minute. If you wanted to be on that primary ballot by any party you want, there was a requirement of you take out your nominating petition and you get a certain number of signatures. And you are placed on the ballot. If you do not want to get signatures, and this is where I had a problem with it, you can pay more money to help fund that election. But you needed to get your signatures. So if somebody from the ABC party wanted to run for the state legislature in our district, where I was in Northern California, I forget the exact numbers because I never ran for the state legislature. But if you wanted your name on the ballot as a candidate for ABC Party, all you had to do was get a bunch of people to register as ABC Party, sign your petition, and you would be on the ballot.
But why should I suppose I don't want to participate. Why should I pay for it?
Well,
Jesus Christ, I don't want to fucking participate with a cop knocking down my door either. Why the hell should I pay for a fucking cop?
No, that's different. A cop's a public employee.
Easy.
On a bike.
Well, for
a
starters,
cop is a public employee.
For starters, this is all driven by the Federal Election Code and the Federal Election Commission, because these are, you know, where the presidency is the only national election that we have. But the down ballot stuff matters too, either on a city. Or a municipality, or a county, or a state level. And you know what? For instance, just as an example here, and I'm talking about West Virginia because that's what I know, we have a little chapter of the Greens. They call themselves the Mountain Party. And they don't have primaries because they can't even compete in every election. So they have a little nominating convention
Last one, I think, was up in Flatwoods. And I don't think they even fill up the hotel there that they stay at. And they get together and they pick their slate. And that's how they go about it. And then they're on the general election ballot because they have chosen not to have a primary because, well, it wouldn't be worth their effort because there simply aren't enough of them. But as for Democrats and Republicans, those are the two dominant parties, and it's not a vicious conspiracy. It's not anything nefarious. It's business, and it's business. It's the business of governance. That's all.
And why should those people who are not members of either main party, why should they be forced to pay for those two parties to nominate their candidate?
Nobody's asked you to pay my way to go to
the
state convention.
Are you kidding me? Who pays for the primary?
To go to the state convention, which is
who
a place
pays for the primary.
And who pays to who pay? Well, if you're going to pay for the primary, you are also paying to elect the school board members, confirm the judges, your city council people, your county,
period. That's what I'm saying.
County government, all those elections were being held in essence before there were primaries. And the primary is just added on to the ballot that already existed.
For instance, you're
not wanting to pay for the election for your city council?
I don't want somebody paying for my private club to nominate a candidate.
You missed my point. You don't want to pay for the election that elects your city council.
You're not listening to me.
But that's the same election.
You're not
that
listening
is the
to me.
Exact same election.
No, it's
where
not.
People
it's the
pay,
set up
where
the
parties where the parties pay
their
share of the printing costs for the ballot.
Who pays for
you
the workers? Who
the
pays
ballot?
For the machines?
Those are the same machines that are used to elect your city council and your county council and
them?
Your judges.
Who pays
the
for them?
People pay for them.
Right.
Everybody pays
right.
for them.
And why, if I'm not a member of a certain party, should I pay for them?
What is the alternative?
Conventions.
Brought to you by the Koch brothers?
Whatever. Look,
you want a convention to elect your city council?
Yes. You have a convention, you nominate a candidate, and then you have a general election where somebody is actually elected to the whatever governmental authority.
But wait a minute. The primary election is the final election for the city council, the judge, the county council, the school board, the dog catcher.
You just said the primary elects the candidate.
Yeah, but on on that same primary ballot, for instance, here in West Virginia, you will see nonpartisan elections, okay? An election for school board in my little county, and it won't have Republican or Democrat on it. Judges, nonpartisan.
It's the same on every ballot.
And so you can't do that in convention assembled. You know, why do I give a damn what somebody in Kanawha County thinks about who should be my county commissioner in Fayette?
I agree. Every county, or however they get divided up, however the parties want to nominate a candidate, have your own damn convention, pay for
it
yourself.
Well, that's great, but now we're back into that same problem you have in fucking Iowa, where you can't participate in what passes for democracy in Iowa unless you're willing to miss work and stay and hang out for hours on end while you flounge around trying to pick a candidate.
Sorry, no.
Yeah, that's the same. Exactly what you're talking about.
No, it's not what I'm talking about. What I'm saying is you want to go to the convention, fine. In your county or however the party defines it, you say, I want to be a delegate to the convention. You get so many signatures, and you go to the convention.
So we're just gonna take
voting completely out of it, disenfranchise people.
It doesn't disenfranchise anybody. It forces people to do it, number one. Number two, I just have a fundamental problem with the government, with people paying taxes to pay for elections, to pay for private clubs to choose. I don't want the Republicans paying for me. I don't want to pay for them.
Yeah, but see that's got so many, that's so fraught, Steve, because that's the argument, and I'm not saying you hold it, but I've heard it too many times. Assholes going and voting against school bond levies because they say, well, I don't have any kids.
But that's different.
No. I don't want to pay to educate somebody else's
Bob,
kid.
That is different. That is a public benefit.
And then there's also...
Who the representative of a private party is not.
I pay my taxes. Why should I have to pay for somebody else to eat?
It's not the same thing.
It comes from the same mind space.
When I've gone to the state convention again in California, because I was a member of the state central committee, and the conventions were held in San Diego, Los Angeles, Sacramento, and San Jose, because San Jose and Sacramento are Northern California, tongue in cheek there, it cost me well over $1,000 to go to that convention. If I am sitting at home in Humboldt County, which is 300 miles north of San Francisco, and I go down to the local school and mark my ballot, it doesn't cost me $1,000 to express my will as to who the party should nominate to be my state representative or my federal House of Representatives delegate. But if you say that everybody needs to go to a convention to nominate the candidate,
I didn't say that.
The candidate for everything. You said that it should all be conventions because you didn't want it in a primary ballot.
You have local conventions, county conventions that go to the state.
I don't care whether it's a local county convention or a state convention. It is going to require a greater expense to the individual to attend that convention than it is to go vote. Now, I realize there are small counties and there are large counties. The county I was in, for one to get from the outermost reaches of the county to this county seat could be as much as a 3-hour drive. So you drive in 3 hours, you attend an all-day convention, and then you drive 3 hours home. You've spent a whole lot. Probably you're going to go and spend the night. The conventions don't last just one day. So all of a sudden, you've got people from the outlying areas that are coming in and having to spend money in a motel and eat in restaurants. And it's a hell of a lot more expensive for those folks. And I think that that needs to be taken into consideration in allowing people from these vast, larger areas to make their choice known without it being a financial hardship? Or should it just be the rich folks in the city that get to make the choice?
Hold on, because in reality...
I completely disagree. I don't even think that's reality.
In reality, there are county conventions. I've been to one. And then from the county convention, you have delegates to the state convention. And these all operate in conjunction with the primary. And by the way, I've seen them be a hot, hot mess. And, you know, just going to your county convention is a pain in the ass. Going to the state convention is a giant pain in the ass that involves out-of-pocket for hotel rooms, meals, what have you. And then you go in there, and it's a clusterfuck. Because that's what conventions are. And the convention ratifies what happened in the primary. I mean, I think this is all in the end. This is all very, very academic, because we're back to Don Rumsfeld. You know, you go to war with the equipment you want, you've got, not the equipment you want.
this is what we have. How do you, you know, how do you win in it? And that was the origin of the question.
Steve?
How did progressives take it in the shorts once again? And I think there are multiple answers. James in Illinois pointed out a few minutes ago, 2016 wasn't about Bernie. It was about Hillary and 30 years of Republicans going after the Clintons. And there is a shit ton of truth in that.
Most certainly so. Hey, Steve, I just have a hypothetical for you. If there was no primaries, and if we went back to the old smoke-filled rooms or, you know, these conventions that you're talking about, would there have been would Trump have been anointed by the Republican Party, do you think, or would it have been Jeb?
I don't care.
Well, I'm just saying. I mean,
I don't know. I suspect it may very well have been Trump, because those would have been the very passionate voters who would have run to be delegates, would have gone to their convention, and would have elected him.
Yeah, I mean,
how do they get elected? If they run to be a delegate, how do they get elected?
What do you mean, how do they get elected?
You said they.
Yeah, you run as a delegate. You get elected in your county or your district or whatever.
Wait, hold it.
At a convention.
Who provides the election
at a convention
for them to be elected?
At a convention. They're a private club. Let them worry about it.
This is a snake swallowing its tail. It really, really is.
But let me just say this. My issue is this. I come at it from a completely different position. Is I find it repugnant that people have that the government that the taxpayers have to fund a private club to choose a candidate, number one. And then for some people to say, oh, the entire public has to pay for this. Yet what we're going to do is, in some cases, we're going to tell part of that public, you can't vote in the thing that you funded. If you really want to make it closed, to be true to the Constitution, you say, then it's not, then the government doesn't fund it.
No, that's not, see, we're still, this is continuing, even though I would like for it to end, but I don't, just because the contentiousness worries me. Here's the example from, and you know, every state is different. But if you're an independent in this state, you can vote in either the Republican or the Democratic primary, or, and this is a big one, you can say, I'm an independent, I'm going to wait till the general election. So nobody's being disenfranchised. And we all, and I'm paying my fair share of the Republican convention and the Democratic convention, and I'm pretty much, I mean, if that's the system we've got, it's a system I'm okay-ish with. And just one last observation, and then we'll find something else to talk about. Because Chris brought up the issue of 2016, and so did James. Just one little thing. And that's this. If the Republican Party, and this is one of those for want of a nail, the shoe was lost kind of things. If the Republican Party had those superdelegates that we so fucking loathe, Donald Trump would not be president.
I would agree with that, Bob. It would be Jeb, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Would have been Jeb.
Wait a minute. No, you don't know that. You know that Trump wouldn't have been the nominee.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
The convention would have picked it who they wanted.
I mean, it's kind of, that would have been a scenario that played out a little bit historically similarly with the one that resulted in the nomination of James Garfield, because the Republicans got together, I think it was in Chicago, and they heard all the speeches from all the assholes, and all the Republican delegates said, we don't want any of these fuckers. Hey, and then along comes James Garfield, gives this magnificent speech, and they go, yeah, him. Just had a note from Lottie up in Massachusetts. Hope all's well with you, Bob. Stay safe. Thanks to tonight's program,
Well, he says, I now fully understand why George Washington, Alexander Hamilton, and James Madison loathed and did not want political parties in the new nation. And what he says is absolutely true. Federalist 10 is an exercise in James Madison tying himself in knots over what are we going to do once we get faction. Faction was the term that they used for political parties. And eventually, through the course of Federalist 10, and the best one on Federalist 10, of course, is Dr. Bill. But eventually he tells himself, it'll probably be okay. Because it was already beginning to happen. And by the time Washington is in his first presidency, by the minute he's sworn in, everybody's gone off into their camps. And you've got the Jeffersonian Republicans and the Federalists, and the Jeffersonian Republicans are doing all they can to try to tear the federal government to pieces, and the Federalists are being equally asshole-ish about trying to make sure that the Jeffersonian Republicans can't destroy the nation before the nation, is a fucking year old. And by the way, one last thing, I need to send out thanks because we're getting ever so close to meeting the when Donnie chooses, you loses challenge. And that's to send thanks out to Kat in Ohio. Thank you, Kat. That brings us down to only $70 to go to meet the challenge. So thank you, Kat. Hopefully we'll knock out the rest of it here in the remaining 30 minutes or so. Go ahead, Sparky.
I saw a story where Nancy Pelosi was running an ad against Donald Trump as on Crooks and Liars, I think. But the underlying thing I took away from it, and it was on, what's her name's show? The one, I can't put it in there. But anyway, that the powers that be are saying on the mainstream media that Donnie's now running against the virus. That's his nemesis.
Yeah, that's a pretty good description.
So my thinking is, as things start to go, he looks like he's going off the precipice. What do you think the Republicans are going to do?
Oh, they're beginning to shit themselves, at least according to some of the reporting.
Because he's going to take them all. He's going to take them all down with him.
Right. I mean, he's got coattails in places like, Alabama and Mississippi, but it's kind of hard to win a presidency with that. And if he, that's why it was so desperate in Wisconsin to make sure that people, that the Republicans had to fuck that up, and they needed the connivance of five miscreants on the Supreme Court. There's another ad out, and the thing is, this one doesn't so much rely on the video. The audio is very good. This is from the Lincoln Project. And that's that outfit from, that's that Never Trumper outfit. And
that's the Rick Wilson Brigade.
Yeah, and you got
Max Boot and the boys.
You got to remember, these guys know how to make a mean, shitty political ad. And I've got the audio here. No money changed hands. But what I like about it is as effective as audio as it is with the video included.
Coronavirus has now killed three times more Americans than 9/11. So what's Donald Trump been up to? Blaming the impeachment hearings for distracting him from preparing for the pandemic.
I think it took a lot of, I see them going and saying about speed, well, I mean, I got impeached.
In January, Trump's own senior advisor issued a memo warning him that coronavirus presented a grave threat to the United States. Days later, the World Health Organization declared it a global health emergency. Where was Trump? He wasn't distracted. He had plenty to do, like campaign rallies and golfing. In February, the virus spread to Europe. While Italy was shutting down and quarantines were being announced all over the world, Trump played more golf and packed thousands of people together. Sounds safe. The day before the first American died, where was Trump? Where do you think he was? At another rally. By March, the world was calling coronavirus a pandemic. Where was Trump? On Twitter, as usual, blaming everyone else. When Trump finally bothered to take it seriously, it was too late for 10,000 Americans and who knows how many more. Trump just didn't care. He still doesn't. He was never distracted. And Americans have been paying attention.
Forceful.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Why can't we do that?
Great question, Steve. Where's Biden? Where's Waldo? Where's Biden?
Oh, can I say one thing about the coronavirus?
That sounds eerily familiar.
The voiceover? Yeah.
Can I say one thing about the coronavirus?
Yeah, go ahead.
That will shock you. My partner is a PhD candidate in Canada. He teaches English at the university where he is. Probably 90 or more percent of his students are Chinese. He told me that they were talking to him last summer or before about a strange new flu that was infecting people in China. This thing has been around for at least a year.
That wouldn't surprise me, given the Chinese government and their want to cover up.
That would explain the sickness I had in January, early to mid-January this year.
And that would tend to lend credence to the ABC report and everybody else now about November.
Yeah, and
would also lend some credence to the idea of the early flu in California, and that the pandemic hasn't been as bad in California as it, quote, should have been, unquote.
Well, there's a counter to this, and Flavio made me aware of it earlier today. From Reuters? No, not from Reuters. From Slate. The title of the article is, "No, you did not get COVID-19 in the fall of 2019. By Jane C. Hu. And what it points out is that this thing, this idea is taking root, and I'm not saying that this has anything to do with your partner, Steve, because there are some differences here between the article and what we're learning now that calls some stuff into question. But there is a level of misinformation that is on the road. And it starts out with KSBW Monterey. And they aired about a story about how California might potentially have herd immunity to COVID-19. And wrapped into the story was mention of a Stanford Medicine report study on blood tests and antibodies on whether or not someone has had COVID-19, and quote someone named Victor Davis Hansen. Well, gosh, if we're using all three names, he's either an assassin or a genius, right? And he's quoted as saying Stanford's data, KSBW reported based on what he was saying, Stanford's data could help to prove COVID-19 arrived undetected in California much earlier than previously thought. And then it got its running shoes on and got going and became a thing. Well, Jane C. Hu, writing the report as a good reporter, first reached out to Stanford Medicine to ask about Victor Davis Hansen. And they said, "Who?" She said, "Jane, yeah, no, that's a bad joke. They never heard of the guy. He's certainly not part of Stanford Medicine. A computational biologist at Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center recently tweeted, there is zero probability that it was circulating in fall of 2019. Allison Black, genomic epidemiologist at the lab Bedford works in, says that the research data bears out what he said.
And now we have to find out who Victor Davis Hanson is. Well, guess what? He's allegedly a Stanford-affiliated source. But he's not a biologist. He's not an immunologist. He's not an epidemiologist. He's not even a chiropractor. He's a military...
Is he at least a Scientologist?
No. He's a he's a military historian wrapped up with something called the Hoover Institution at Stanford, which is a right-wing think tank which has a vested interest in advancing the, oh dear God, we must all stop quarantining, we must all go out into public and die to save the precious markets. He's one of those fuckers.
He's a freeper. Yeah, free enterprise. Yeah.
And he recently published at where? Yes, that noted scientific journal, National Review.
Oh, yes.
You know, the home of American racism since 1960.
I wonder if these guys, is he an anti-vaxxer by chance, Bob?
Well, he says things like, much of the virus modeling is nearly worthless. And when he uses the word science, he puts it in scare quotes.
Oh, jeez.
And then he blames it on, he blames the arrival of the virus on Chinese nationals. The fucker does everything but send group Captain Mandrake out for rainwater and pure grain alcohol.
Why one might think there's something racist there.
Why one might.
Yeah. You know, along those lines, it's interesting. I've actually talked about, I live in the neighborhood that I live in. It's very Asian. And I've actually, I don't really know how to do it, but I thought about putting together a neighborhood watch to make sure none of my neighbors and whatnot are the victim of some New York City cockknocker maggot beating on them.
Well, and that's the other part of this story. If you actually look at the data of travel to China, there were as many good God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing, Christ-centered, whatevers, you know, white folks, Merkins, flying back from China or more than Chinese nationals. Dirty little bastards, you scratch them. I mean, you don't even have to get anything under your nail bed, and you go, and oh, look, racism. Sons of bitches, you know. Now, that's not to say that I think that the timeline as it's being presented to us is on the up and up, because it isn't. And John, it was you who sent the subtweet my way of the Trump regime saying, the Defense Intelligence Agency? What's that? Never heard of it. No, we didn't talk to him about nothing. And yep. The denial is more damning than the silence was. So, thanks for that.
Yeah, no problem. I'm always seeing stuff like that. And that's what I was trying to say, earlier, you know, this is the kind of corruption that people, that we can't have for another 4 years. And that's why I'm not begrudging anybody for not voting for Biden or anything like that. But people that have platforms that are YouTubers should not be, you know, engaging in soft voter suppression for our own side, because we cannot have this corrupt shit for another 4 years. So we might not even have anything to resemble.
Yeah, see, John, it just so happens that there are people in this country with enough privilege that they figure they can survive 4 more years of Donald Trump, and they frankly don't give a fuck about anyone who can't.
Exactly. You know, there's this, you just hit right on the nail, man. They had a nail right on the head. Like, you know, there's a lefty YouTuber that, you know, you would have gotten along with him very well before 2016, end of 2016 primary. Because you and him are the only commentators who actually focus on the religious stuff, and you call it out and stuff, and he does too.
Oh, I bet I know who it is, but I'm not going to name names.
You know who it is. He's a younger guy. And so I used to let you admire him back before, back during the 2016 primary. But when he started doing, hustling this Bernie or bust shit, now it's actually them. They're making money off of this actually now, these people.
It's a market. It's a market.
Yep. Jimmy Dore, all of them, they're all the same now. I mean, except for, I like Sam Cedar. He doesn't do that shit. But his co-host, who isn't on very often anymore, Michael Brooks, he's just like, even though he feuded with Jimmy Dore and doesn't like him, he's just like Jimmy Dore. And he's making money off it, frankly. And I think it's un-American. It's unpatriotic.
Well, just one point there with Michael Brooks. He told his listeners to vote for Hillary. And he has told his listeners now, you must vote for Biden. So, definitely. No question.
But why do you think it has become a running gag on this program that anytime I say I like something, somebody like Billable Rick or Steve or anybody will immediately respond with, stop telling us how to, Bob.
Because
all during 2016, even though I said, look, this is what I'm going to do, I'm not telling you what to do. I got hate mail saying, stop telling us how to, Bob.
Well, all I can say is you're pretty shallow if you can't take Bob for what he is.
I mean, some of this has to be fun. Oh, and by the way, I've got an update on Victor Davis Hanson, courtesy of Angelo in the People's Republic of the Bronx. Quote, Hanson is still a major George W. Bush fanboy, writing that, quote, his tenure was without corruption, unquote, calling Bush a centrist and going so far as to say he may be a model ex-president. Apparently, any day now, historians will recognize Bush as another underappreciated Harry Truman-like president, and soon he will rise through the historical rankings of presidents. Yep, any day now, still waiting, but it'll come. Any day now, yeah. And
what about George W. Bush's pandemic speech? That's going around.
Well, yeah, because even a blind hog finds an acorn now and then. I mean, that's the one thing I don't think we get, Sparky, is. Even through the death toll and the infection rate, we still don't get the breadth and depth and scope of the monumental nature of what a fuck-up Donald Trump is. He's been a fuck-up all his life. He's going to be a fuck-up till the day he breathes out and doesn't breathe in again. And it's just going to be fucking up all the way. So,
Bob, it takes a lot of work to be a worse president than Harding or Hoover or Reagan or W. Yeah. It takes a lot of work to be that bad.
Yeah.
And he is.
Trump has got it.
All day, every day, and twice on Sunday. Oh, I have to.
He already won hands down.
I have to. Yeah, but here's the risk, Sparky. Somewhere out there, there's a Republican who has the power to be even worse. Remember how we don't
even know him yet.
Right. Oh my right.
God.
Yeah, it's kind of like how the Bible talks about the Antichrist. But I got a cowbell to give out.
I think his name's Tom Cotton.
And that's for Jeremy in Vermont, who just said, "Stop complaining about us complaining about you telling us how to complain about things, Bob." for the ages.
Stop telling us.
That was beautiful, Jeremy. And thank you to our dear sister Jude in the Great Northwest. We're down to $60. We $60, 16 minutes, and we can meet the when Donnie chooses, you loses challenge.
Yeah, James in Illinois says, for instance, he's worse than James Buchanan. And, you know, James Buchanan was an early lie hopper, because you can argue that, and successfully so, I would say, that James Buchanan let the Civil War happen.
He's all above, and he's a dick.
Yeah, and somebody
said, have you ever met a bigger dick in your life? Hey, hey, Bob, how you doing, brother?
Hanging in there. I hope you are, too.
Yeah.
Somebody mentioned Tom Cotton. Well, not just him. I mean, there's a bunch of them out there. There's that new and different kind of Republican, Ben Sasse.
Sasse.
Yeah, and don't forget about Raphael.
Oh, yeah. The
booger eater.
The booger eater.
Hey, can I, let me say
Cruz
something real quick
shot
about
his shot.
Can I say something real quick about people who won't vote for Biden? When I see someone say that, my next thing is to say to them, okay, I'll give you my address. You can go ahead and send me the checks, the payment for my medical issues. If we reelect Trump and we get rid of Obamacare, because I only have health care because of that. So go ahead and do that. Maybe $400 or $500 a month, that ought to cover some sort of insurance policy for me.
Well, the problem is it's the Supreme Court that could eliminate Obamacare, which, you know, neither the Republicans nor Democrats have direct control over. And true. So the question is, what's going to replace it?
Oh, but hold on, Rick, because there's some questions been asked of our attorney general here. You may recall me talking about him. That would be Pill Push and Patty Morrissey.
Oh, yeah.
People are asking him, hey, in the middle of this here pandemic, what do you say you sign off on a motion to null pros your participation in the suit to take people's health care away?
Oh, there you go.
And I don't know. I don't think I know how to do that.
Did you see where Biden's now going to be lower the Medicare age to 60?
See, that's and the cool thing is that was what was planned all along. Medicare was set at 65 when they got it passed. Johnson was going to have a second term, and he'd have a Democratic Congress to work with. They'd lower it to 65. They'd lower it to 60. They'd lower it to 55. And the next thing you knew, we'd have Medicare for all.
Mm-hmm.
That was the plan. And then Vietnam completely fucked everything up for him. And the next thing you know, you got Nixon.
Mm. And Vietnam fucked up a lot of things for everybody. Yeah. You know what? I found my draft card yesterday or the other day.
Burn it.
Hell no, Sparky won't go.
I'll burn it with my. You could burn that, and I'll burn my bra.
Well, it's actually two draft cards. I found
you should sell them on eBay, Spark. You can make some money at it.
No, it's got my name on it.
Delete some of that. Redact some of that.
I got my registration card when I first registered at the post office here in Red Bluff, and then my student deferment card that shows me as 2S.
Hmm. How long did you defer it for?
Just one year.
Hmm.
I just pulled my draft card out of my wallet. It has an issue date on it of 2/28/2018.
What?
I'll give you the backstory. I decided back when Schwarzenegger was the governor of the state of California.
This is where you got on your local draft board.
Yep.
I remember that.
And yeah. So I conned my way into Schwarzenegger appointing me to the local draft board because I figured there had to be some kind of subversive around when the next draft came up. And when I moved to Oregon, I simply transferred being on the local draft board. And so I am still carrying a draft card from the United States Selective Service System. If you really want to be subversive, get on your local draft board because they cannot find enough people to serve on draft boards. There's vacancies all over the country.
And if the shit ever really hits the fan, we need some subversives on draft boards. So come on, sign up, folks. Get in touch with your local selective service system. Find out if they need anybody on the draft board. I have yet to go to a meeting. I have had to do some online training and fill out paperwork.
Did they give you the secret password and the handshake and all of that stuff?
No. I didn't get a secret password, but I did get a certificate that's worthy of framing, and I have a lapel pin, just like the members of Congress have when you see them on TV, that could identify me as a member of the draft board if I so choose to wear it.
I'll be darned.
I think you should, Roger. Like, walk around on a power trip with it, you know?
That's close enough to a decoder ring. thanks going out. Thank you very kindly to Jack in Shreveport and to Gary. Thank you, Gary, very kindly. I think I know, well, it may not be Gary, but I thank you. I know. And that means that when Donnie chooses, you lose his challenge has been met. And so we'll probably wrap the week up down a couple of $100, but this is a substantial improvement to where we otherwise would have been. Thank you very kindly. And by the way, the way the mind of this community works, at the same time that Jeremy was sending me the email that got the cowbell, Jimmy, on the opposite side of the country, was typing, "Stop telling us not to stop telling you to stop, Bob." So, yeah, beautiful things.
Psychic waves went out over the internet.
Yeah, I mean, Marianne Williamson's got nothing on me.
Tracy wants to say something.
Yeah, go, Tracy. I heard you earlier about you were gonna set fire to something.
No, my bro. When they said Sparky was gonna, you know, somebody saying Sparky burn your draft card, I said okay, and I burn my bra along with it. So there you go.
That works.
That part. So
hey, but you probably didn't need a bra back in 1969, did you?
What year was that?
1969.
I was three, but you know, it's a thought that counts. It's solidarity there. You know, come on.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, Tracy, you and Phyllis Stapley.
Can you make a good one to make a mask?
But you can use your bra. You can use your bra now as a face mask, Tracy.
Yeah.
Yes, do you have a recommendation? I mean, I've been using. Alex actually ordered some stuff that he got, and they, as part of the order, they sent him face masks. Now that is mandatory in California. Well, is it just California? Is it just LA? Or is it all over California that if you go out in public, you got to wear a mask?
I think it's L.A.
I think it's L.A.
Here. Yeah, in Orange County.
When I went to the store today,
if you're an essential worker, you've got to wear a mask here in Orange County while you work.
Well, because I actually had on a mask when I went yesterday to buy fresh donuts. So that part, but doing my part. But so, did you guys hear that? So I just found this out I got a sales call yesterday from, I signed up for an online course to keep myself busy. And, you know, of course it was free, but then of course you get the people calling you. Well, you know, you sign. I'm like, bitch, did you not understand that I am not working? I am not signing, giving anybody any money unless it's packed. I mean, AT&T, my rent or what have you. So no, but anyway, the guy that was calling me was from South Africa. We were just talking about the differences. Do you know, as of today, they have only reported 24 deaths in the entire fucking country because they took it seriously. They went on lockdown a long time ago. Do you know if you need to leave your house to go anywhere, you actually have to have a pass, that the police are actually checking passes and stuff like that. And then they're talking about extending it even further, but 24 deaths so far in the entire, I mean, not this, I don't know how big, you know.
What is it? It's about 30 million, 40 million people?
I don't know, but the fact that they only have 24 deaths in the entire country.
That's amazing.
Speaks volumes.
Isn't South Africa almost the largest country in Africa?
Not population-wise, it's Nigeria, I think.
I thought it was Egypt, but maybe it's Nigeria.
Yeah, I'm not. I'm,
they're doing something right. I mean,
57 million people.
It's not that difficult. Stay the fuck at home.
My son yesterday, because Alex, you know, we're all home. So Alex did an inventory yesterday of, you know, the food that we have, the meat, the protein that we have in our house, in the freezer, in our house, in the refrigerator and freezer, in the garage. Let's just say I have enough meat to cook exactly for at least 2 months. I'm no frozen stuff. There's at no reason for me to actually buy any more meat. They had the pretty much a lockdown here in LA for the week. Janet and I haven't gone to the, we went to the store last week, right before all this, the shit really hit the fan in LA. And so we'll be fine until at least Monday, as far as, you know, the only thing I have to do is like replace milk and bread and stuff like that, but and fresh produce, you know, but it's just, yesterday I actually made, we had two chicken thighs left over from something that I made. And I saw this, the coolest thing on TV. You know how, and I wish these are those things that, damn, why didn't I think of this sooner? So this woman was talking about, you know, how to stretch your food out. So you know how you cut up your vegetables for whatever, you always have those leftover crazy end pieces and stuff like that. She's like, throw it in the water, in a pot of water for a broth.
Yes. Duh.
Yes.
Great, so that's what I did yesterday. I threw some vegetables into the pot with the chicken thighs, and I made an amazing, very simple chicken and rice soup. I didn't put the rice inside of the soup because, you know, if you do that, it's funky. So I had the rice on the side, and oh my God, it was so good.
Hey, you know, you know what's really good?
You got to make your own soup now. You can't find it at the store.
That part.
You're right.
You know what's you know what's really, really good inside the soup, too, and it provides a really nice chew, is barley.
Yes, and we have barley.
Pearl and barley. Tripped.
So we actually, so when we did go shopping the other day, you know, there's still some, you know, there's a lot of scarcity and certain, you know, especially seasonings and stuff like that. So we saw bouillon. I'm like, oh, yay, bouillon. I got it. So yesterday I opened it to put in the soup for the base. I didn't even realize it when I bought it because I was just so happy to see it. It was actually a tomato-based chicken bouillon.
Whoa.
Oh, my God. Dude, that shit was on fire. It was so good. I mean, seriously, just that alone and some Italian seasonings. I didn't have to even put any salt in. It was just that base, just the chicken, tomato bouillon with a chicken base or whatever.
Bouillon base.
No, not bouillon base. Just no, it's a bouillon.
Oh, ooh, yummy.
Mm. So it was a tomato. It was a tomato bouillon with, you know, with a chicken base. Holy shit! I had never seen it. I have never seen anything like that before. I think maybe because we got it from Gelson's.
Oh, Tracy,
yes, baby. Who's calling?
No, I'm just.
That just sounds.
That just sounds. You know what we need to do? Okay, Tracy and Bob and everybody else. Here's what we need to have: a horn cookbook.
That could be fun.
Well, I'm not sure to write it, but what Tracy's talking about is you save all your vegetable peelings. I don't care what they are. All your vegetable peelings. Put them in the freezer for a little while. When you get enough of them out there, throw them in the pot, simmer them down for, well, if you've got, depending on your cooking abilities, not abilities, but accoutrements, tools, let it simmer down. Put it in a jar. I don't recommend it, but it can be done. Hot water bath it, put it in jars, or boil it down even further, make your own bouillon paste. It's called being a food preserver, whatever. Add a bunch of salt to it. Get the salt up high enough and get it dry enough, and nothing's going to grow in it. And you can make your own bouillon base based on tomatoes or vegetables or beef or pork or chicken or whatever. All of that stuff can be done, and I'm sorry we're at 4:59 p.m., and I can't get into the food preserver shit
tonight. Roger.
But it's all possible to do at home safely.
Roger, you're the Larry Flint of food porn.
And James in Illinois. James,
I'm not sure where that's coming from.
No, I'm just saying the stuff that you talk about is so freaking good.
And James in Illinois, subject line, Tracy, boil the bones. Boil them for hours.
Oh, yes, that's what I did.
Called bone broth.
Yep, nothing like it.
Also, I have a pressure cooker.
Put a little vinegar in that. Pressure cookers are fantastic.
I have three. I have an Instapot. I have the Ninja Foodie. And I also have a rice cooker / pressure cooker.
None of those are actually approved for canning.
The pressure cooker that I have is approved for canning.
Okay, if you've got one approved for canning, that changes your ability for food preservation for the super future, and that's great. But you really a pressure cooker and a pressure canner are two different things. So you need something that can get to 10 to 15 pounds consistently for a pressure canner. But if you just have the old fashioned pot that you put the thing on and it rattles and it turns the most rank piece of beef into something that'll flake away, that's a pressure cooker. But
No, I do have one.
Well, we're gonna wrap things up, but I have to send thanks out to Elizabeth. Thank you very kindly for taking us into what remains. Thanks tremendously, Elizabeth. And thank you all so very much. And Joey, I got your note, and we will do that. But I had a feeling that because I already had Dr. John booked into the first hour, we will assay that early next week, hopefully. And Lady B, I saw what you wrote. I had to immediately mute my microphone and sat there and laughed for a while. But you know, didn't have to pull the car over to the side of the road. When I mentioned it's Friday, I got a note from Jack in Shreveport. Crap, I forgot it was Friday till you mentioned ending out the week on the front porch. I'd completely forgotten it. So you know, maybe we're doing our little part toward maintaining some semblance of normalcy, because I have seen that in social media, people going, I don't even know what fucking day it is anymore. And so at least you know, with the weekly setup of Moran Monday and Trumptanic Tuesday and prayer meeting Wednesday and Thorn in the Side Thursday and Friday on the front porch, maybe we can all just kind of keep a semblance of normalcy until we get a return to normalcy, whenever that is, and hopefully it won't be as badly as we all want it. It won't be too soon, so that we won't have a horrible, horrible spike in this monstrosity. So all of y'all have a wonderful weekend, which may feel like just any other day. Stay safe. Wash your hands. And you know, I was talking. I mentioned the other night, and Brother Deacon Asa said, you know, we could do that. We could have movie watch party nights, as long as everybody gets the same movie, and we can all sit and watch together. On our various devices, as long as everybody's got a camera, that could be a lot of fun. I don't know. Shoot me a note if you're hearing this. Lady B wanted to know. There's rumors going about that some folks are getting their stimulus checks early, as in today. Anybody else hearing that? Actually, I heard the exact opposite. That there are people who won't see shit until August. Who knows with this bunch? Who knows? So, again, thanks to all of you who keep this on the air, who keep this conversation going so that we can all keep each other something vaguely resembling sane. Thank you for sharing your time. Thank you for keeping the bills paid. Thank you so very much. To our all-volunteer staff, thanks to Sparky and Steve. Thanks to our news ninjas. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa. Thank you, John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Cold River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. 20-plus years at the forefront of the struggle for human rights and environmental justice in Appalachia.
And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Have a wonderful weekend, everybody, even if it doesn't feel like one. Later.